time to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people will turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. Though thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live audio at several locations. You can hear us at timeforanawakening.com. which is the homepage, and you catch the live stream at that location. We're streaming live audio at www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and the live stream is playing there also. We're streaming at abibitumi.com. That's abibitumi.com/timeforanawakening. They stream from Ghana. Or you can download the TuneIn Radio app to any of your devices. TuneIn Radio is a free radio app. In that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had a Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with a live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. It's Time for an Awakening radio program, the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 6:08 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening, this Sunday, March the 15th edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening is you, an open forum conversation. And you can always join that conversation by dialing 215-490-9832 with a question or comment in this open forum Sunday. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 6:13 on the Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide to African American Museum here in Philadelphia, 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right, Elliot. You know, this weekend were really Friday. I was involved in a discussion of cultural groups, and I was pleased that we, you know, the convening organization, which is a collaborative to bring together local cultural organizations, was asking us to think about, map out a 50-year plan, looking at 2076, you know, 50 years from now. I was pleased with that because usually I don't hear us having those kind of visioning, you know, discussions. So that was exciting, and I'm glad that we're here in open forum, because maybe get an opportunity to get some feedback for those who are listening, who might be able to offer what do they see 50 years from now. So, but other than that, all is good.
Yeah, well, Richard, we're in open forum. There's even no guest scheduled. We do have some guests, upcoming guests for the next couple of weeks, but we got an open spot for our listeners to get involved in the conversation. I'm curious. Well, you don't necessarily have to mention some of the groups that were involved, but how did the conversation, where did it go? What were some of the things they were saying? And
it's interesting, Elliot, to that question, because my bias is that it's kind of difficult for us to, think in that manner. People were pleased that we were asked a question, but to your question, most people gave a reference point as far as the, the challenges they were having as a cultural institution, and the challenges they seen in evolving, whether that's because of, finance, or access to the community itself. My particular bias was in relationship that we couldn't pinpoint, because some of the things, this was a query for me, important. I've been thinking of this, one of the things I would have turning it to me, which I know I wouldn't have enough time to do. Because it was a several different organizations, you didn't want to hog the time. But my thing is that we needed, as cultural organizations, we need to change the focus from being about, shifting from tourism and hospitality or, traffic and destination to community development infrastructure. I'm a believer, Elliot, that we should set the basis within our community of our culture, what culture is. We should control it, is what I'm saying. And what cultural organizations are now kind of primarily have to do is look for people to come to their institutions more than being a part of the infrastructure of the community as a part of community development. And the reason I'm adamant about that is because we need to set, for me, culture is about values and beliefs that shape behaviors. And right now, we may have certain values, but the broader society, which I don't believe is in the best interest of Black folks in general, and even specifically, they shape the behavior. We send our children to school. They're telling us what they're going to need to be able to get a job. They'll tell us what the curriculum is necessary in order for them to be able to know what is it to be an American. And all of that is absent of what it is to be Black in America. And I think that that's what cultural institutions should do, but they have to be in the community. They have to be where Black people are, not looking for tourists or particular social economic groups to come to their destination. So that's just an example to me of, a kind of vision that eventually we will be able to be the progenitors of what it is to be Black in our communities, what is the beliefs that we have, and that will assist in the behavior and all the other things like the libraries, the rec centers, and the schools, because the next generation will be bombarded through that compared to having to go to a class trip to an institution, if I'm making sense.
Richard, if you look around, the global Black world, these things of a vision for our people are being discussed, whether it's on the continent with the 2063 plan, whether it's some of the things that we've been highlighting with past guests, working with people repatriating, being accepted into the lands of their nativity, free borders on the continent. You heard Sister Favia of the Afro-Venezuelans when she talked about the meetings that were being held down there by several delegations from different states in Venezuela that were represented by Afro. You remember when she was talking about that?
Oh, yeah.
And the things that they proposed to the government that the people wanted. So you can see that as it's movement in the black world globally.
Right.
That movement is not talked about here. It's definitely not talked about by white media. And your black representatives and black media, by and large, don't highlight it because it's somebody else. It's not American blacks. I don't know how they're viewing it, to be honest. But those things are necessary to give our children hope and a vision for the future. Because if you just look at our situation here and being dependent on the white society, there is no hope for our children here. When I say here, I'm talking about in this system. I do believe that whatever shakes out, some of our people will be here. And there's nothing wrong with that. Similar to what Brother Safiwe was talking about when he was on the program about 3 weeks ago, about it's not necessary for a lot of this conversation that's going on social media about blacks this and blacks on the continent, they hate us and all that, the foolish talk. Because it would probably be necessary for blacks to be here. You got other nations. For example, they had a big celebration a couple of weeks ago about the Asian or Chinese New Year. And here in Philadelphia, I know in particular, they had young Asian children, you know, with the masks on and different stuff. I didn't know what it meant, but they knew. They knew what it meant. And it didn't come from no Chinese culture here in the United States. They were just continuing a culture that had come from their motherland.
Right.
And the children were actively involved in it. But they live here. They live here in the United States. So they're continuing a culture that is ancient compared to the United States, 200-400 years old, whatever, 250 years or whatever, however they determine it. It's less than 500 years that they've been here. But you got people from other areas that have a ancient culture, just as we do.
And the Irish just had their parade today, if I'm not mistaken, had the street blocked off for the Irish Day. They partied last night, as usual. I don't know if they do it every other place, but they damn sure did it here.
And one of their leaders came here and was speaking to the president, this president here. And which he's Irish, even though he, they claim American. So, you know, it's necessary to uphold and hold on to your culture. That's your rudder. That's what keeps you as a people. That's what keeps your peoplehood and things to pass down to your children. Not dancing in the street and hip hop is a culture, and you know, like stuff that needs to replace things of value. Sometimes we latch on to things that really don't mean anything, but we haven't had anything among ourselves that's been expressed as a collective. If you follow what I'm saying, Richard.
I make the case, Elliot, that. Besides the opposition, not that we haven't, for centuries we've been having parades and celebrations. I think every, almost especially urban areas, or we go down to Mardi Gras in Louisiana, but, you know, Adunde here, that tries to, and these are new things that come that we've done each generation to celebrate that cultural thing. But the question about governance, being able to control it on one side, you know, and then on the other side, protect it from being either destroyed, I mean, or interrupted is something else. And I've been using this term governance because when you're governing your culture, then you know you are to celebrate it, but you also are to protect it. And, you know, but what happens when you generate your cultural behavior, your cultural beliefs and your cultural behavior, and it becomes an enemy to the state? What happens? And more for Black people than any other group in America, so may, even the indigenous nations, I don't think, you know, even with the warfare they went through, they have not constantly, their cultural production has been not just, I mean, at one point it was to be wiped out, but to be eradicated from one generation to the next. I would like for the Time for Awakening audience, anybody to like refute that point. But it seems that Black people, especially after we came through the 70s, to say you were Black and proud, to say you're Black and beautiful, to be able to have create different cultural products that connected you to here and to the continent, to as a continuation, that became a problem, Elliot, as I seen it.
Well, it was definitely a problem. Because this country always, since the day we arrived on these shores, been trying to sever that connection between the continent and Blacks here. That's always been their driving force, their mission. To get Black people to believe they're a separate entity, that they're not related to, which is weird. It's really weird what these people have been trying to do for centuries. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut across you.
It's weird and that the memory loss from one generation to the next doesn't get put across that way. And let me be clear. I'm not negating the experience that Black folks and institutions and cultural norms we've created by being here. I'm not negating that.
No, you can't.
You know, I'm saying that it's always been, if we look through our history, we have always looked at ourselves as a global people. And in that, and the importance of that is because it will, it directs our commerce. It should, right? And it should direct our politics, right? It should. But the reason why the opposition is so intense here in relationship to us taking control, maintaining control, that's the opposition. Now, why we don't recognize that we need to put some defensive barriers around, that's another issue. But why they don't want that, because as a now empire, you know, with colonial tendencies, they wouldn't want us to have our own relationships with the Caribbean, with the South America, with Africa, with Australia. They wouldn't want us to have that because look at the size of that population, interconnected infrastructure that would be created and the influence, even though we're only, now people talk about 13% of the population. What would that mean from a power dynamics if we had an infrastructure where we were the mediators of that global relationship? Because of our historical and cultural connections.
Well, it's not in their best interest to foster that, Richard. So if it's not in their best interest, then it's not in your best interest as far as they're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in their best interest to do that. But it's in their best interest to strengthen ties between them and their brethren on the European continent. You see it all the time. We just played a couple of clips here recently where speeches was made in Germany and other places by some of these president elected officials strengthening ties between European nations.
historical ties. When you say, people say, well, Rubio isn't English, you know, and, you know, some would say he's Cuban, but then others would say he said, and that when he was to Munich, his Spanish, you know, those European Spanish connection. And they were at war with each other. Florida was a Spanish colony. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the British, you know, and you know, that the British, you know, British Americans, you know, were in direct conflict war with because of the power they gave to those Africans who were in that area when we're talking about the 16th and 17th century before they took over. And which makes me think about that piece you communicated to me about, you know, what's going on in Florida now in the bills, you know, and how they're again, I think the person, what's her name, Yvonne Benavent, she's Hispanic, pushing through some legislation, if I'm not mistaken.
Richard, the I want to play based on some of the things that you said. I got a clip here of, and I always want to thank Brother Maurice Carver up there because we kind of talk, and when he runs across different things, he'll share them with me. He sent me a clip there with Gregory. He sent me a couple of clips that I'm playing on the program. This first one is Meeks, Gregory Meeks, at the security conference, a security council. He's a ranking member of this nation's security council. And he was talking in Congress recently, days ago, about the present situation and what's going on, the Israel, United States, I guess the United States of Israel's offensive in the Middle East. And they have the other European brothers involved too. Planes are being launched out of Great Britain, I think France. You know, this president of this country said when that conflict started that, you know, it'd be over in days. And they were going to control the Strait of Hormuz, and they were going to use American ships to escort tankers out of the Strait of Hormuz. Now, all of a sudden, he's asking for help for other nations to send warships to deal with the Strait of Hormuz.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you heard that latest development, Richard. The United States was supposed to be dealing with the Strait of Hormuz. Now, all of a sudden, things is shifting. Planes going down, and a plane just fell down and refueling. But when you look at other broadcasts, you don't see it's something else going on that never reaches these shores here or these broadcasts here. But I just want to play something that Meeks said in his address. And it's clear, Richard, that you're on one page and these people are on a totally different page. I don't want to say they're on another page. They're in another book.
Uh-oh.
I mean, because, and see, listen, I understand why they are. See, a lot of these people are not dumb. I got some that I believe are less intelligent than others, but I'll keep that to myself. But a lot of these folks are not dumb. They play both sides of the fence for a reason. And there's a lot of factors involved in that, whether it's money that they're taking from special interests, money that they're taking from religious organizations, or they're afraid if they say certain things that they'll be violating their oath of office and might lose their political entrepreneur seat. It's a lot of factors involved. But I want you to listen to what he says, Richard, at this Security Council hearing. And I want to come back to you to get your thoughts. And the Time for Awakening listening audience can hear it too. And they can weigh in. We're in open forum, and they can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. But let me pull this up if I can get this here. Wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. No. This is not it. Hold on a second. Be patient with me, Time for Awakening listeners. I'll have this in 1 second. This is it.
Now recognize Ranking Member Meeks from New York for any opening statement you may have.
Thank you, Chairman Mass, and thank you, Undersecretary Rogers, for appearing before the committee. I am really glad that we are holding this hearing today. Particularly because we've not had many administration officials to be before us. So I'm pleased that we will have you today. And, you know, I can't help but say and again ask the chairman for more hearings with administration officials, particularly in regards to Iran. You know, we have not had one single administrative witness testify publicly on Iran in the past year. And even after the administration bombed Iran in June, I would have loved to have had individuals in here from the administration to talk to them. Loved to would have had the conversation with Mr. Witkoff and Kushner about what has been taking place with regards to their conversation. I do believe the American people deserve to know why the president has taken us to war and what the objectives and nature of the imminent threat are and how much it will cost the American people. To me, these are just basic questions that should be easy to explain before dropping bombs. My constituents, of course, did not elect me to be a rubber stamp. But let me go back to you, Madam Undersecretary, and let me say...
Richard, let me pause there. So you hear how he's kind of...
I was making that note down, not allowing me to be a rubber stamp.
He's been elected by his constituents to not be a rubber stamp. Okay, yeah. Listen, come in, these people... oh, boy. Wow. But you hear what he's saying about this administration getting involved in this war.
Right.
But they're not in it by themselves. Notice that he don't mention Israel.
Mm.
He's talking about Jared Kushner and whoever this other person is that never talks to them. Number one, they don't feel as though they need to tell you anything. Those blacks are in those offices. What did Derek Bell say? Interest conversion. I think his explanation to interest conversion was that whites are only interested in helping blacks so-called progress when it also benefits them.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was just saying exactly. That's the principle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to. You're not making any decisions here in this country for these people. You might play along with it, and they use you for votes or to pass legislation. But these blacks are not making any decisions. They don't want to hear what you got to say. They feel as though they don't have to answer any of your questions, to be honest. But he's asking like, well, let me play a little bit more, because to kind of formulate what he's saying, because you hear it clearly.
Let me say this.
Go ahead.
And it's only a question that bugs me. And what he said, his constituents doesn't want him to rubber stamp. But what does his constituents want as it relates to this? Is my question that I don't seem to hear being developed. It may be developed as we go on.
Yeah, well, if you notice, whether it's him, Jeffries, any of them, they're concerned about this conflict going on now. Number one, they don't mention Israel. None of them does. None of them do. They talk like the United States is in this by themselves, and they're not. But they don't. I'll play a little bit more, and you can kind of get what I'm trying to say. I'll let him say it. I'm going to continue on.
And start emphasizing a point on which I think that we do agree. Public diplomacy is not symbolic. It is our frontline tool for ensuring the United States, not China, not Russia, shapes how billions of people understand democracy, freedom, and American values. It's how we counter foreign disinformation and propaganda, and it demonstrates United States leadership to win the hearts and minds of individuals. Now, we need to tell that story. And I, quite frankly, from what I have read and too often, when I've looked at some of your statements, which I have had some problems with, like political engagements and social media activity, rather than this, I think it should be a global message, not just something subject to Europe. You've met in Europe with a lot of partisan political actors in Europe and publicly criticized allied governments and domestic policies, where I think you should be explaining Americans' foreign policy.
Richard, did you catch what he said?
About Europe?
Yeah. He said, it's troubling to me that you've been meeting in different places in Europe and you're not touting a global policy. You're touting a European or allied policy. Did you hear what he said?
Yeah.
I mean, do he realize who he's talking to? They're going over there trying to rally support from their brothers. What are you talking about? I mean, that's the question that he's asking. And all their whole thing is public diplomacy drives American policy. The last time I checked, when they said that they was talking to Iran about nuclear weapons, they were in the midst of quote unquote public diplomacy.
Right.
And then turn around and kill this Ayatollah and 40 other representatives of the government. They did the same thing in Venezuela. Supposed to be public diplomacy about these drug boats and blowing up people's fishing boats and destroying people's economy in the Caribbean Sea. And then they come in and snatch a man and put him in prison, say, in a drug deal. In the midst of public diplomacy, these things were done. And that's a track record among Europeans. When they were here supposedly having diplomacy with Native Americans, the next thing you know, they were attacking them. This seems to be their modus operandi. This is what they do. Now, he's puzzled to why they're going over to Europe and making speeches like I played that Rubio when he was talking about we're family. That's basically what he was saying. We are family.
Western heritage.
Yes. And having something to pass down to our children. And he's curious to why are you crafting your message that way? That's what he's asking.
I want to bring this up with that, Elliot, and as you get back to play to the rest of his, his remarks. But, you know, it seems that Black Americans always have had a different global view of how America's foreign policy should be administered in relationship to other nations. It seems that Black America specifically has recognized that there should be a multipolar understanding between nation states. But when he said pushing America values, America has never really acknowledged, as you say, other than, and I like the way you say that, their brethren, every other, especially in the Southern Hemisphere, they were all to be either under the auspice of America's might and power, not to be nation states unto themselves, not to, even when they did that United Nations, not to have self-determination in their own right to determine who should be the rightful rulers, not to be told what how democracy should run. They should be utilizing that, you know, diplomatic approach, America, and Black America specifically, in order to be able to create a mutual agreement of relationship more than being in conflict and war and domination. That is what Meeks, or I would want Black representatives and Black interests, you know, on a global scale to project more than what American values, because that becomes vague to me, Elliot. You know, because we American values, 47 said it was the Monroe Doctrine, which means what? All of this is mine.
Yeah, might, and might said, makes right.
And what did right? Might makes right. Not no cooperative notion, but might makes right. That's, you know, I mean, and we see the history. They exterminated many nations on this land to get this land. So it ain't no new thing, this what we're seeing there. And so I just had to bring that up with, about, you know, hearing them say American values, because it makes me wonder, well, what is the stories, the diplomatic stories that they're going? Because it seemed like Rubio was given the diplomatic stories.
He was.
You know,
he was.
All right. I'll leave that alone.
Let me, I'm going to continue on.
A lot of partisan political actors in Europe and publicly criticized allied governments and domestic policies, where I think you should be explaining Americans' foreign policy, that I think is what your mandate is. And your public statements on migration and political issues in allied countries have at times caused controversy. And your activities in Europe, you know, from what I'm told, has disrupted U.S.-EU trade discussions. And I've even understood from my just doing some quick research that some of your senior officials in your own administration have raised objections to that approach. So I'm concerned that the focus of your tenure at times appeared more aligned with advancing a domestic political brand than strengthening America's global credibility. That is not public diplomacy, and it diminishes the credibility of your undersecretariat and the professionals who serve within it. The public diplomacy mission was not meant to be confined to one continent, which I was talking about earlier, or one issue. It's global by design, and for a good reason. You know, China is rapidly expanding state-run media, cultural diplomacy, and exchanges around the world, while Russia continues aggressive information warfare. Authoritarian actors are filling influence gaps wherever America appears absent. So U.S. public diplomacy has never been more important or needed, and should not be neglected. The world is watching an America that has launched trade wars and military wars also. They are trying to understand what America stands for. That is precisely, I think, the mission of your office, and that's why you're there to do just that. This should have been an opportunity.
Richard, let me say this before, because it's winding up. Did you hear him say, the world is trying to understand what America stands for? You heard that?
Yeah.
Richard, let me say this. The world now, and especially the world that he should be concerned about, they're not trying to understand what America stands for. A lot of these nations know what America stands for. Iran had been calling the United States, and not the land, but the people, the great Satan. You heard them saying that. They already know what these people stand for. They want to know what you stand for. You, Black elected officials here, Black people with prominence, they want to know what you stand for. They already know what these folks stand for. What are you standing for? That's the big question.
Now, if I may, Ali, as you finish up on this, to that point, because that's another puzzling thing. As I hear, I hear in other places, you know, when we talk about black elected officials and we talk about black political interests, we know when they get elected, they take an oath to the United States of America. Therefore, it takes an oath to its domestic policy and its foreign policy. And we know that the history has been that the United States has really not respected people of color throughout its history. So should we expect these elected officials to, even though they get voted by a constituency of black people, to represent or be aware that black people either agree or don't agree with Americans' foreign policy? Or should we expect them to just be representatives of America? Meaning that though they get voted by the populace, they really don't really work in the best interest of the populace in relationship to their interests, political interests, their values, or their outlook in relationship to the world. Should we look at them just to be representatives of the United States or representatives of the people who elect them?
Well, number one, they should be representatives for people who elect them. Mm. In fact, that's the pretense that this government tries to tout. That you're supposed to represent your constituents, the people that elect you. But they don't. They represent the best interests of the government, whether it's not in your best interest or not. In fact, you could see that all the quality of life indicators show that it's not in your best interest.
But it is in the best interest of certain groups.
Yes.
Corporate interests. There's individuals that they represent. We see the outcome, whether it's now with Iraq, as most people would say. Who comes out? The oil interest comes out, benefits from this. Even if they can't get access to foreign oil, these multinational domestic oil companies have, you know, they say government reserve, but they're private companies. Don't they benefit from oil, gas going up to $5?
Yeah.
The military, the Lockheed Martins and McDonnell Douglas, you know, what they say?
Raytheon, all of them, they benefit from these bombs.
Yeah, $1 billion a day? I mean, don't those bombs got to be replenished? And don't those stockholders get benefit every time? Because don't that money come from the government, which is the taxpayers? So when we talk about the people, you know, and again, now black people have never had no large scale industries like that. So our representatives, you know, our notion is that they have no other should. But represent the interests through the party system of the people who put them in office. But some of the stuff that you share with us, they don't even do that. They represent another group interest because they say elections cost money. And the group interest who's able to pay, support them financially, get more interest. I don't know if that made sense.
Let me play the rest of this, and because I want to throw some other things into the mix. Let me finish this out.
To showcase American leadership and values, you know, we're hosting FIFA World Cup and celebrating America's 250th anniversary. Yet anti-U.S. sentiment seems to be rising, and some countries have issued travel advisories for the United States. Tourism has declined, and the perception environment makes your mission more critical, not less. So Congress needs to strengthen and did strengthen public diplomacy under the Secretariat at State because leadership in public diplomacy is essential to national security. The authority carries expectations that America's global voice be coordinated, credible, and focused on advancing America's standing, not weakening it. And so if public diplomacy is perceived as partisan or ideological rather than strategic, it will undermine its own effectiveness and hand our adversaries exactly the narrative they want. It erodes trust and undercuts our power of persuasion. So I know you got a big job ahead of you. I look forward to hearing from you, and I hope that we can refocus the office to a degree to its actual mission. But I do thank you for being here because it's been rare for me to see people from the administration before this committee. I yield back.
Now,
Richard, you know, you just mentioned when we first started this conversation about tourism. You remember you said that, Richard?
Right.
And you heard what he said about we get ready to have the World Cup here and tourism has been affected.
Right.
And the nations of the world, the America's been getting a black eye or something he said, the reference there. Instead of speaking out saying that this type of stuff is wrong, blowing up schools, girls' schools and killing a bunch of young children at school, blowing up civilian areas, apartment areas, this stuff is wrong. Now, it's bombs being sold, too, on the other side. Mm-hmm. But that was in response to bombs being thrown at another people and the killing of somebody's supreme religious leader.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are not discussed. The only thing in reference to that is, well, you didn't come to Congress to get approval. Not this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't agree with somebody's government. Because they don't want to incorporate homosexuality in their government or treat certain people. That maybe they got cultural norms, how women's supposed to be in their society, have their face covered or whatever. That's somebody's culture. That's what they do. You don't like it, so you want to change it. What gives you that right? But Europeans think that they have that right. They do. And if you don't go along with it, then here comes the bombs.
And they got somebody that's going to be the overseer for that area who they're supporting.
Richard, something else I wanted to throw in because Tim Merck, the professor from University of Cape Town last week mentioned it about the need for and you can see that this is a work in progress, what's going on in the continent and with the AU and some of the countries with young population, just about all of the nations there have young population, that this is a work in progress. It's not happening overnight. You ain't going to snap your fingers and all of a sudden the shackles of neocolonialism are going to drop to the ground just like somebody take off their clothes. It's a work in progress. Now, he mentioned about the need for open borders.
Mm-hmm.
He said this is one of the last vestiges of neocolonialism, these borders. Because a lot of African countries have free trade agreement.
Mm-hmm.
But with borders that's not open, then you're almost defeating your purpose. Now, I'm no economist, but that's just me kind of looking off the cuff. Would you agree with that, Richard?
Oh, definitely. I mean, they talk about it all the time. The difficulty, just one thing, as far as the currency exchange as a challenge. The other would be visa, you know, having to have your visa, you know, in order to move in a country next door. So, yes.
I mean,
oh, I'm sorry.
Yes,
I'm
that's late.
Yeah. But yeah, let me.
Those are two things.
Well, let me throw this in there because when he mentioned that, I went and pulled this up and just share it with the listeners. The majority of European countries maintain an open border policy through the Schengen Agreement, which was which has abolished international border controls for 29 European countries. This area functions as a single jurisdiction for international travel, allowing over 450 million people to travel, work, live across member states without passport checks. The Schengen agreements were formulated in 1985. A treaty was created, has created Europe's Schengen zone, a zone abolishing international border checks among the participating countries. It allows passport-free travel, enhancing free movement, tourism, and business development while standardizing visa policies and strengthening external border security. So Europe has went to open border policy.
Right.
And even though, now I'm no economist, but I think they have that euro also. I think they have the pound and other, but they also have the euro.
Right.
So they have established these policies.
Right.
But they make sure these other countries don't do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They still have a North and South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
They still have a Taiwan, China. I think that's the last stronghold that Britain held on to was Taiwan, which is part of China. Mm-hmm. They still have all of those separate entities in people's government, last vestiges of their neocolonialism. Mm-hmm. And just like Tim Murtry said, he said those borders on the continent is one of the last vestiges of neocolonialism that has to be shaken off.
Mm.
They don't operate like that, but they want other people to operate like that.
Mm-hmm. Those nation states themselves, which is constructions of, you know, that colonialism, and how those governments, even after independence, are still interconnected into those, the infrastructure, the global infrastructure, which is predominantly still tied, not like before, but still tied to those Western European countries and corporations, which we've seen or heard earlier in the year and last year, you know, in relationship to how those three countries, was that Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali, was or is addressing it in its new fashion as far as trying to create some unification and moving out France as France, the infrastructure that France has, but it's still tied to a broader global infrastructure, European design, when we're talking about the IMF or its other relationships that it has to have with other African countries that may be like, you know, the countries that are a part of the Eurozone or a part of the Portuguese and even some of the Arab, influence countries. It still has to work through that in order to be like to work and look inward to those, if they're going to keep using those nation states construction of how do they create an alignment with each other in spite of this European hold that they're tied to.
Richard, and again, we're in open forum. You can get involved too in the conversation if you want to throw something out and mix something into the pot. Here it is, jambalaya, so to speak, by the 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Richard, I got a few other things I want to throw in, but you sent me earlier that position thing sent out by the Heritage Foundation about their vision for America in the next 250 years. And they referenced the Moynihan report in that, mm-hmm. you know, and that goes to what you talked about in the beginning. These folks have a vision, or they they want to have a vision for their children in the next 50 years, 100 years, or whatever. And this happened in mentions 250. Yeah, it remains to be seen whether 50 years this place, you know, is active and around, but that's another story. But, you know, I mean, you see this. The thing about it, let me read what it states here in this paragraph, Richard, and throw it back to you. It says here in this, it's called Saving America by Saving Families, a foundation for the next 250. It says, when the Monahan Report, The Negro Family, A Case for National Action, was published in 1965, Daniel Patrick Monahan, then Assistant Secretary of Labor under President Lyndon Johnson, was also concerned about 25% non-marital birth rate for black women that he called for national action from the federal government. In the decade since the report was published, that rate has nearly tripled. The changes in marriage culture and family structure that have largely been associated with low-income neighborhoods in the country's largest cities have taken a new shape in recent decades. Today, the national non-marital rate is 40%, and one quarter of American children live with a single parent, the highest in the world. Now, Richard, what do you see kind of strange in that statement that was made?
You know, that it, one, that if it's talking about America in general, but then it uses black America's, quote unquote, marital challenges. I mean, it was very specific. And then saying, you know, that it basically that the war on poverty created the problems of black divorces and marriages in general. Yeah, that's one of the first things that I picked up.
Yeah, but see, listen, I read between the lines of these reports. Now, it's using the Moynihan Report, but that's not really what it's saying. Let me go back and read something, because he referenced the Negro Family, A Case for National Action. Now, you know that in that Moynihan Report that came out from the Johnson administration, they really wasn't concerned about black people.
No.
They was just using them as a prop, so to speak. Now, check out what he's saying. Let's read between the language. Let me go back here to this paragraph or this couple of sentences. It says, I'll read it again, but I'll stop where I want to focus on. It says, when the Moynihan Report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, was published in 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then Assistant Secretary of Labor under President Lyndon Johnson, was also concerned about the 25% non-marital birth rate for black women that he called for national action from the federal government. In the decade since the report was published, that rate has nearly tripled. The changes in marriage culture and family structure that was largely associated with low-income neighborhoods in the country's largest cities have taken a new shape in recent decades. What's the new shape? See, everything that these folks do that's directly trying to attack you, it always manages to backfire. See, that's the new shape. That's the backfire that has happened. This stuff was directed to destroy black families. But it's destroying white families. These whites ain't having no children. They ain't having children.
And you know, Elliot,
but that's the new shape he's talking about.
You're right.
These things were designed to destroy the black family, but now it didn't backfire. But they can't put that in a language like that, because it would seem like a racist, so they'll just disguise it.
Or they don't want to show the dysfunctionality of white family. Because they're talking about poor white families. And I have to add this. Later on, you'll find that Moynihan came back after this Hare report, years later, I think maybe 10, 15 years later, with a report about the changing shape of white families, of poor white families, because of the transition of this economy, I would argue.
Well, it's not limited.
White. It started out with blacks, but then he got shot and saying, damn, this is happening to white folks too.
Yeah, but it ain't just limited to no poor white families. White families in general are not having children. I don't care whether they got money or don't. They're not having children in comparison to black families.
Right.
So this thing that was designed to destroy black family life, which is still trying to do now, and you'll see in some of the things that I'm going to read shortly to share with you. But now it then backfired, and it's destroying white life. Mm-hmm. White children, birth rates low. In fact, it states that in this report you gave me about the low birth weight, a birth rate.
Mm-hmm. Which means how can they maintain it as a white country, which was always been a fear they've been putting out there, floating out there. It, you know, the browning of America. If they have a low white birth rate, and they can't do white immigration like they done in the past.
Richard, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. You know, we always talk about the farmers and the stuff that this nation does and these folks do against to destroy black land ownership and black farmers. I'm going to share something with you. And again, I credit the brother Carver. He sent me this hearing on the farm bill, this new farm bill that's being formulated now, you know, with the SNAP benefits cuts and all the other things. Mm-hmm. Well, something else was cut. Now, let me set it up by doing this. First of all, I want to play a clip that we're familiar with. There's something Dr. King said that last. This is about a minute clip. But first I want to share this. This is from the Colleges of Agriculture and Land Grant Universities Public Policy from the National Academy of Science in the United States. It says, in 1862... almost 50% of all United States residents lived on farms, which employed almost 60% of the labor force. The business of that day was agriculture, and the land grant college and agricultural system was mandated to teach such branches, to teach agriculture and mechanical arts, to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial class in several pursuits and professions in life. And that was the Morrill Act of 1862. Now, let me play this to kind of set up what I want to present here. Listen to what Dr. King said in reference to what I just read.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
Now, You heard what he said, Richard, about the formulation of these land grant colleges, right?
Right.
Now, let me share something with our listeners. Because in 1862, these schools were established to teach, as Dr. King says, their white peasants coming from Europe to give them an economic floor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll just, because it was 59 of them, and I'm not going to read all 59. I'll pick some out here because they're some of your most popular. Auburn University, the University of Arizona, University of California, the whole system at the University of California, including UC Berkeley, Colorado State University, University of Connecticut, University of Delaware, the University of Florida, the University of Georgia, University of Idaho, University of Illinois, Purdue University, Iowa State University, University of Kentucky, Louisiana State University, University of Maryland at College Park, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, Michigan State University, Mississippi State University, University of Missouri, University of Nebraska, University of New Hampshire, Rutgers University, New Mexico State University, Cornell University, North Carolina State University, Ohio State University, Oregon State University, Penn State University, the University of Rhode Island, Clemson University, Texas A&M, Virginia Tech, Washington State University, West Virginia University, University of Wisconsin, and I'm not even finished the list.
Right.
But those are some of your largest, predominantly white universities that were started in 1862 by the land grant college money from the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, let me do this. It was 59 schools, and I've just read some of the 59. The Second Morrill Act, because that was the first in 1862. The Second Morrill Act mandated access by African Americans. It gave rise to a set of historically black colleges located in southern states, known as the 1890 colleges. There were 17 of these schools.
Mm-hmm.
16 public colleges and Tuskegee University. The 1890 land grants institutions were all historically black universities that were established under the Second Morrill Act. And here are the, and I'll read all 19. Alabama A&M University, Alcorn State University, Central State University, Delaware State University, Florida A&M University, Fort Valley State University, Kentucky State University, Langston University, Lincoln University, North Carolina A&T State University, Prairie View A&M University, South Carolina State University, Southern University, Tennessee State University, Tuskegee University, University of Arkansas Pine Bluff, University of Maryland Eastern Shore, Virginia State University, and West Virginia State University. These were all the black land grant colleges, just like you had in 1862, 59 white land grant colleges. Now, let me play a statement that was made about a bill that was proposed based on some legislation that had been enacted in the Farm Bill, along with the SNAP cuts and all these other things. Let me play what is stated here by this representative figures in Alabama. Listen to what he states in reference to what I'm talking about and what Dr. King said in 1960, I think it was early 1968, before he was murdered. Listen to what is being stated here.
Adams is, you seek recognition, Dr. Adams? Okay, sorry. I'm sorry. Ms. Figures from Alabama is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate Congressman Scott for his amendment to provide permanent funding for our 1890 land-grant universities. These institutions are vital, not just because of their historical role in correcting past iniquities in higher education and agriculture as a whole, but because today they remain on the front lines of serving communities that are too often left out of federal investment, agricultural opportunity, and economic growth. And as some of you may recall, in the early days of this administration, we dealt with a still incomprehensible issue where this administration came in and they terminated the land-grant scholars program for 1890 institutions, and they did not touch the land-grant scholars program for the 1862 institutions, which is just still incomprehensible. Said another way, they terminated the funding for, in my state, schools, the two land grants that we have in Tuskegee University and Alabama A&M University, but they didn't touch the funding for scholars at Auburn University. To say that a different way, they terminated the funding to the predominantly black, historically black colleges and universities, but they did not touch that to the predominantly white institutions. And we questioned the secretary about that, and it happened, you know, relatively early on in the first few days that she got there. We still never quite got to the bottom of why it happened, but we know that it happened, and fortunately it was reversed, at least in part, which leads us here today. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go over to Tuskegee, which is in my district, home of George Washington Carver.
Now, Richard, before I finish playing it out, you heard what he said about the
right,
the money for the land-grant colleges.
Right.
The extensions program and all. You heard John Boyd and also Thomas Burrell talk about the extensions and how
right,
these extensions offices is in these different states. So you see where the money was cut for the land-grant
right,
colleges, but only the land-grant colleges that was black.
Right, the 1890, yeah.
Yes, the other ones, the money's not cut. Now,
the 1862.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you see this narrative that's going around by black elected officials that black people should be happy about 250, ready to blow fireworks and jump up and down and party in these cities. When this type of stuff is going on right before your eyes, and sometimes you don't even know it. These are the things that need to be broadcast on black media. So black people as a whole can know exactly what's going on. It's attacks against black people going on as we speak. And these people are thinking up new ones all the time.
I agree.
You know, you don't need to sugarcoat it. Talking about, let me say it this way. Let me say it another way. Why don't you just say what it is? You afraid you're going to offend these people? They ain't afraid they're offending you. They done cut the money. And then when he asked them about it, they didn't give him no answer. They figure they don't have to answer you. You just do what you're told. Don't question me. Let me finish. Go ahead.
And he said reversed in part. So,
well, because he's going to explain it. Let's see if it was reversed in part. Let's see whether, you know, whether it's, you didn't get anything, your money was cut, but then they throw you a couple of crumbs. Let's see whether it's the reverse in part. It's just some crumbs being thrown down there so you can scramble on the floor like you're some type of dog. Let me just keep on going.
The bottom of why it happened, but we know that it happened, and fortunately it was reversed, at least in part, which leads us here today. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go over to Tuskegee, which is in my district, home of George Washington Carver and all of the great agricultural work that that icon did. And what I heard there was deeply concerning, especially because of these challenges that have emerged in the last year. The USDA liaisons that help administer this program are no longer stationed at the institutions themselves. Instead, a small number of liaisons are now shared across multiple 1890 schools. Several of the liaisons have retired. No new ones have been hired due to a hiring freeze, leaving only 6 to 8 liaisons covering multiple campuses across the entire country. And it is important to understand what these liaisons actually do. USDA liaisons that are assigned to these land-grant institutions, they act as a critical connector between the federal government and the universities. They recruit and support the students, particularly for the 1890 National Scholars Program, and they help institutions and faculty navigate USDA programs, foster research partnerships, connect campuses to grants and technical assistance, strengthen workforce diversity across the Department of Agriculture. When those liaisons are stretched thin or missing entirely, as is the case now in many places, students lose access, faculty lose opportunity, and USDA loses one of its strongest pipelines for talent and innovation. Compounding this problem, liaisons currently do not have travel budgets. That means if a liaison is not physically near a school, even if that institution is assigned to them, they're often limited to virtual engagement only. For students navigating federal careers and programs for the first time, virtual-only support is not sufficient. Scholar support has also been significantly constrained. While institutions continue to support previously awarded scholars, schools are now limited to only 2 new scholars, only 2. And because this liaison position falls under the Office of Partnerships and Public Engagement, which does not currently have adequate funding, vacant positions cannot be replaced. We were also informed that under the direction of this USDA, regardless of how large or robust an institution's agricultural program may be, schools are capped at a maximum of 3 scholars, even when there are many more qualified applicants. And this is, this is down from the 6, for instance, that University of Tuskegee or Tuskegee University has had in the past. They're only now down to 2.
Now, I'm going to continue it out, Richard. Do you see what I'm talking about?
When
he said it was reinstated in part, those are the crumbs that are thrown down there, almost like you're throwing food on the floor for a dog, and he's scrambling around trying to grab it. I mean, are you kidding me? But when you see all these meetings, Divine Nine and all that stuff, they're jumping around with a step show and all this other foolishness, these are the things that need to be discussed. These are the things that need to be discussed. You ain't getting the money to go to school. Then when you go, you be this type of stuff. This is a total attack on black life, period. Almost in every facet. Whether it's job, I'll get to some of the other stuff that I'm talking about later on. This is a total attack. You heard Professor Ricky Jones from Louisville talking about this is a total attack. You heard him when he was saying it, Richard. This is a total attack. Now you see why. You remember when Thomas, Brother Burrell was on here and he wanted some type of amicus brief from the land grant schools. And you asked him, why ain't they getting involved? Now you see why, Richard. You see why.
I can only shake my head, Ellie. I mean, let me say this, because in other media, social media, people chastise me because as much as we've discussed this, as you're sharing here and the discussion with Mr. Burrell, that it should be more be said, because you listen to some black folks, they think everything is fine.
Yeah,
black farmers did get some money, so they should be happy. You know what I mean? And it's like really difficult to bring people up to speed who ain't really even paying attention.
That's the thing. That's the thing. And these people need to bring this to your attention. They're not. They're having these hearings. They don't come back and have public hearings with the people and let them know what's going on. They don't. Just so happens that Brother Maurice kind of follows a lot of this stuff, and he'll share it with me. And then I'll turn around and share it with you.
Right.
Let me finish this so people can hear it.
For students navigating federal careers and programs for the first time, virtual-only support is not sufficient. Scholar support has also been significantly constrained. While institutions continue to support previously awarded scholars, schools are now limited to only two new scholars, only two. And because this liaison position falls under the Office of Partnerships and Public Engagement, which does not currently have adequate funding, vacant positions cannot be replaced. We were also informed that under the direction of this USDA, regardless of how large or robust an institution's agricultural program may be, schools are capped at a maximum of three scholars, even when there are many more qualified applicants. And this is, you know, this is down from the six, for instance, that University of Tuskegee or Tuskegee University has had in the past. They're only now down to two. It's not about a lack of talent or a lack of interest. It's about a lack of commitment to this program. And this is at a time where we know we are losing farmers, we are losing agricultural professionals, we are losing the scientists and the researchers that support this type of work. We should be doing everything that we can to increase and enhance those opportunities. Permanent funding for 1890 institutions restores capacity, strengthens partnerships, and ensures that these universities can continue delivering education, research, and workforce development to the communities that rely on them. If we are serious about equity and workforce diversity and the future of American agriculture, we must be serious about investing in the institutions that help make that future possible. Alabama A&M and Tuskegee University are certainly those institutions that will make that future possible, but they need the funding, they need the support, they need the investment from this Congress and this Farm Bill, and they need it now. Thank you, and I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. Any members seek recognition to speak on this amendment? Any other members seek recognition to speak on this amendment? If not, I'll take that opportunity before we vote. I want to thank the gentleman.
That's a recorded vote.
What's that?
I'm asking for a recorded.
Well, let me speak first, and then I'll make sure you get a recorded vote. You bet. I want to thank the gentleman for a steadfast commitment to supporting the 1890 scholarship program at USDA. The scholarship plays an important role in supporting undergraduate students at 1890 land-grant universities that result in a well-equipped workforce for students in food, agriculture, and related fields. I've been proud to work with David Scott on this and support him as he's advanced this. That is why I personally made sure that within H.R. 1 we provided $60 million in mandatory funding for this program, which is now part of the law. I'm also proud that this bill, we reauthorized this bill for another 5 years, so that's taken care of. This amendment, unfortunately, was scored because of the mandatory funding that it contains. But given the investments that were included in H.R. 1 for this program and the committee's intention of delivering on a cost-neutral bill, I'm not going to be able to support the gentleman's amendment. But just keep in mind what we were able to do in H.R. 1. And I do look forward to continuing to work with the gentleman on supporting our students at our nation's 1890 institutions. With that, hearing no further conversations, the question is on the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed by saying no.
No.
Independent of the chair, the noes have it, and the amendment is not agreed to.
You hear that, Richard?
Yeah.
Trying to appeal to somebody's sense of morality that this is wrong, you know, because a lot of black folks say, oh, if we can convince these people that they're doing wrong, we can change things around. And, you know, I'm being sarcastic, but all the explanation he gave, and they know this history better than he does. They still, no, you know, we ain't changing nothing.
It shows, you know, this whole thing of the power relationship, you know, and in order, well, this is what comes to mind. Is it to be, when we're talking about 250, and this here march, this supposedly long march without a story, which was said,
earlier, you know, without a story, without black folks having a specific story of what this 250 years have looked like for us, not America, because every time they say it, they talk about America, right? But what has looked like for us is these the struggles that we should be continuous to show that this is a continuation. You said from 1890, and this is 2026. This is a bill in 2026 talking about something that was passed in 1890.
I mean, it ain't funny. I you know,
I can't do it, Ellie. I can't. I mean, because, you know, it requires us to have, and you hear me say, I can't do it. As much as I try to search to bring forward, because we should have a specific narrative about America. And then before that, I hear the brother saying, Richard brought that up. But even if you dealt with the headline of the heritage, they're talking about 250 years from now.
Yeah. Yes.
When I said 50 years to black folks, when I said 50 years from now, educated black folks say you can't talk about it like that. Because we're orientated. They got us orientated to these 5-year planning programs. Well, at the most, maybe 10 years. But this think tank has no apology. It's non-apologetic to say we're dealing with now, thinking about 250 years from now, and still got to ask the question, what are we going to do with them Negroes? I might not be able to tell that narrative or two, but this is what comes, it seems to me, and this is right in front of us.
Yes.
It ain't, you know, it ain't conspiracy. It ain't, you know, I mean, it's, and we're not, it's something that we need to be really cognitive about. And it isn't just in social media. I mean, I go around to these organizations and I've heard people even say, because they make it that we got to think practically, not principally, practically. And when we think in practically, we're only trying to get, what you call it? The crumbs that are being left off the table. Only because you barking, I got to give you some. I wasn't going to give you nothing, but you're barking, I'm going to give you something to shut you up. But if you was running wild on your own, you'd be able to, you feed yourself. You'll be acting out of your nature, and you'll be utilizing your environment and being able to sustain yourself and also procreate and sustain your next generation. Richard, this stuff here, you hear my tone, it makes no sense. Richard, and you can't get no conversation out of black folks.
Did you hear the guy at the end, the facilitator of that USDA mm-hmm. session say, well, listen, I work with Mr. Scott. Mm-hmm. I think that was Bobby Scott or something. I work with Mr. Scott and giving funds, and I secured $60 million for the next 5 years. So, I mean, you break that down, divide that. But $60 million for that program. Over the 1890 school, 19 universities, $60 million by USDA.
You thought the MIT is getting $60
million? No, wait a minute, Richard. But let me put this in perspective. Let me put it in perspective now. $60 million by the USDA. Now, do you know what their total budget is for the year? Because it changes each year, but their total budget. Let me read this. This comes from the, because it goes up. USDA handles a massive budget, often exceeding $200 billion annually. The 200 the 2024 budget was over $200 billion. The projected budget for 2026, which is this year, Richard, is $234 billion. The budget is the projected budget for this year's USDA. $234 billion. And this guy talking about, I've worked with Scott and I promised him $60 million for the next 5 years. If that's not crumbs that you done threw on the floor, I don't know what is. I ain't no mathematician, but $60 million out of a budget of $234 billion in 1 year? And you promising $60 million for 5 years? Richard, maybe, come on, man. Maybe I'm a little slow.
No.
That man should have jumped up and said, you kiss me. No, I ain't going to say that. Come on, man. I mean, that's insulting. That's worse than insulting, Richard. They got a budget of $234 billion, and you promising somebody $60 million for 5 years.
And Elliot, let's be clear.
What's that? A little less than $15 million a year, 5 years. I don't know.
This is at a period where these here agricultural or land grant colleges are now moving in a whole new phase, right? In the sense of biotechnology, synthetic biology. This is what's coming out of agricultural schools, genetics, because this is the industries of the future. If you're not able to get no more than two people who can be able to come to it, if you're not able to fund it, especially in areas where Black people primarily reside, what kind of industries can you build within this new, what they're calling, and maybe I'm out of line, this fourth industrial revolution?
That's my point, Richard. What is, look at their vision for Black people. You supposed to be a partner. I'm an American. I'm an equal American with whites. That might be how you feel. But look at what they're doing. That don't show that you're no equal partner with these folks. They trying to strangle you, almost like you got somebody over a table just choking them to death. They trying to strangle you. Man, Richard, I don't know what. Listen, let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You can get involved too by dialing 215-490-9832. It's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We're in open forum. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. Abibitumi. Black Power. Abibitumi. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometsu Black family, to join your interconnected Kometsu Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com. Abibitumi.tv. Abibitumitv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
We are the watchmen on the wall. You are too. You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye. But we're supposed to be the watchmen for the people that vote for us. The sad thing is the people vote. They don't give you the money to run your campaigns. So here come big business.
How are you? How are you, Judge? How are you, Alderman? How are you, Congressman? How are you? How are you, Reverend? Well, what can I do for you today, Reverend?
You can't do nothing for me. See, that's what we got to be careful of. We got to be careful of who we bow down to. But see, when you get in your congregation and you talk this Jesus, this powerful Jesus that's sitting at the right hand of the Father with all power in his hand, then you go with your hat in your hand to the governor, to the mayor, to the president, begging for some crumbs. You have sold your God cheap. And you make the white man downtown disrespect all of us.
There are between 38 and 50 million people in the United States of America who are poverty-stricken, making income less than the poverty level. And yet, this is the richest nation in the history of the world. Our national gross product this year will go beyond $800 billion. And yet, there are between 38 and 50 million people who are poverty-stricken. Now, there's something wrong. A lot of people are afraid to say it. But I don't mind saying it. You see, somebody said to me the other night, don't you think, Dr. King, you are going to have to start speaking more in terms of the administration's policy? Because since you started talking against the war in Vietnam, it's hurt the budget of your organization, and people who once respected you don't respect you anymore. And I had to look over and say, sir, I'm sorry, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I don't determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of my organization. And I don't determine what is right and wrong by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. And so because there's something wrong, our struggle must continue.
Some of us see the United States as the righteous empire, imperialism, colonies, and the colonized. Either you were on our side or you were on the side of evil. This is a war of good versus evil, and of course, our side is the good side, our track record to the contrary notwithstanding. This is a war of right versus wrong, with our side being right, including our extermination of the Indians, our enslavement of the Africans, our training of assassins, our unqualified support for Zionism, our complete disregard of both the Palestinians and the United Nations resolution supporting the Palestinians, our suppression of third world peoples, and our disregard for the world's opinion about our racism and our refusal to discuss reparation for blacks and the victims of the West African chattel slave trade. No, our absolute arrogance in refusing to acknowledge any wrongdoing in the slave trade. We won't even say, I am sorry, and it's probably because we ain't sorry. Like I have said for years, if we repent, we just might have to repay. And we ain't about to repay. We can repay the Jews, we can repay the Japanese, but we ain't about to repay the Africans, because this is America. United we stand, and in God we trust. That's what you got on your money, but that ain't hardly what you got on your mind. What we trust in is the almighty dollar. Our money and our military. We are a righteous empire. Empire, imperialism, colonies, and the colonized. And you're either on our side or you're on the wrong side.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:51 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. We're in open forum this evening. You can give us a call with a question, comment, or just an event.
Wait a minute, Elliot. Did you turn your clock back? What's up? 8:51.
Oh, wait a minute. Well, it's 7:52. I'm sorry, but I don't know what I'm doing.
You done put us into the twilight zone? Yeah. What's up with that?
No, it's 7:52. I'm sorry. Oh, this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. We're in open forum. You can give us a call at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Richard, the... You know, I just read over that hearing at the USDA in reference to the that committee that that is over the agriculture, Department of Agriculture, and it's also a thing on there where they talk about the SNAP benefits and the cuts. Where he's mentioning about his area and the effects that it will have, the SNAP cuts will have. If I can pull that up, I'll play that also in reference to how those cuts from not only the SNAP, but you know, I just read over the cuts to the land grant colleges. But he also talks about those SNAP cuts and what it will do to the community in general. I don't have that handy, but I'll share that either later on or maybe in another program, upcoming program. But Richard, the you know, last week I read over those figures, unemployment figure that was released for March,
Right.
And near the end of the program, and I did want to kind of expand on that because they did a report for 2026. You know how the Urban League do that report on Black America, where they did the report, The State of the Dream, 2026, entitled From Regression to Signs of Black Recession. And this report was done in January of this year. And it kind of talks about, you know, the state of Black America under different things. It breaks it down into different categories. But before I kind of highlight a few of the things that they put in their report, I just want to read a couple of these things in conjunction with what we talked about earlier. African-American workers, and this comes from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. It says African-American workers are experiencing a disproportionate surge in job losses in 2026, continuing a trend that intensified in late 2025. Now, keep in mind, Richard, all of this is based off that Supreme Court ruling in, I think, June of 2024 when they abolished affirmative action. Mm-hmm. Not DEI, because the court didn't abolish DEI. They abolished affirmative action. Now, and to detract a little bit, you know that that Robinson versus Kalius decision will probably be coming up in June, which will gut the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Right.
And many of these Black politicians you see now will lose their seats. So they'll have to come back to the community or do something, find something else to do. But that'll gut that Voting Rights Act if that's passed or abolished, if it didn't pass, however they term it. And all the signs show that it will be. But let me go back, because I kind of diverted there. It says African-American workers are experiencing a disproportionate surge in job losses in 2026, continuing a trend that intensified in 2025. Recent data from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics indicate that more than 567,000 Black men lost their jobs in a four-month window between November 2025 and February 2026. Let me repeat that. Recent data from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics indicate that more than 567,000 Black men lost their jobs in a four-month window between November 2025 and February 2026. As of February 2026, the Black unemployment rate stood at 7.7%, significantly higher than the national average of 4.4%. While this rate fluctuated slightly from the high of 8.2% in November, it remains the highest among all racial groups. Black women have been hit particularly hard, with reports showing that they are losing jobs at more than three times the rate of all women. Between February and July of 2025, Black women lost 319,000 jobs, a stark contrast to job gains seen by white and Latino women during the same period. Now, let me read that again, because from what I understand, see, I don't go in there and see all this stuff, because it's really not my focus. But I understand that some people have this stuff on social media where Black men is sniping at Black women and vice versa and tearing one another down.
Mm-hmm.
But let me read that again, because I want that to sink in, that 567,000 Black men lost their jobs in a four-month window between November 2025 and February 2026. And this other one, that last sentence, I want that to really seep in. But let me read this one again. Black women has been hit particularly hard, with reports showing that they are losing jobs at more than three times the rate of all women. Between February and July of 2025, black women lost 319,000 jobs, a stark contrast to job gains seen by white and Latina women during the same period, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
So the last time I checked, black women, black men are not firing black women off to these jobs. And black women are not firing black men off of these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants to see the family go hungry. You see that report that was referenced in that heritage thing about black women heading up a lot of these households.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who's going to head them if they're losing their jobs at a rate higher than any other women, let alone white and Latino women, any women? Who's going to feed these children? See, that's what I'm talking about, Richard. This stuff is headed towards a dead end, and some of our people don't realize the seriousness. And some of them, it might not be their fault. Because a lot of our people rely on their so-called elected officials or black media to sound the alarm for them. And a lot of these medias are not doing it. They're just not. Now, let me read that last one here. Because I talked about the men and women. Let me read the last one. Because that youth, they consider you 16 to 24. But when you got somebody over 21, they might be a young adult, but they're an adult. It says youth instability. Black youth experience extreme volatility, with unemployment spiking at nearly 30% in late 2025 before settling in at currently at 18.3%. So that's the total family being hit hard by this. The total family, Richard. Black men, black women, and youth, children. Both young girls and boys.
You know what strikes me when I hear these numbers, though, Elliot? What I'm thinking about, and it's maybe I'm just living in my own head. Because one thing that is happening, we know that at one period, a lot of these jobs weren't necessarily corporate jobs. These were they called the service industry jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So, which already didn't pay a lot, but you were working, right? So here you have this massive layoff of the working poor. What gets me is this stratification, what concerns me. Because some black people, and it's a small number percentage-wise, you know, who are working, still working. They still may be working in public transportation. They still may be working in some areas at the, you know, security in these corporate buildings. They still may be working at, you know, lower level clerks, even in municipal, more than state, because where state offices are, they're not usually where heavily concentrated black folks are, right? Though that group see themselves different than the ones that's getting displaced from jobs, because they see themselves working. And then you hear languages, you know, about how they, you know, those, they might feel sorry, they may be family members, but they can't support them. So they create, instead of we having a language of how we unify because of this, we're now at odds with each other because of this. And those who lose those jobs, though, especially those women, but I see young men too.
Mm-hmm.
You see, can you imagine the frustration you have? You have a little child. You trying, as a man, a young man, you trying to be that father. And you work in three jobs. You ain't married.
but you working three jobs so that you can be able to say that you taking care of your baby. And then you lose that job. You basically not, you ain't driving as it is, which is another, you know, expense if you can drive because of some other things that may have happened. What I'm trying to characterize, Elliot, that my concern that there's a strata of Black people who will write off even when they're hearing that. Now, if they heard them numbers from, and I'm only using this as an, because it comes to my mind as a symbol. If Divine Nine women lost jobs in that number, and they ain't saying that it's a lot to have it, would we hear an uproar in the media, Black media? I think so.
Well, you have had, you know, this job loss is not limited to Black women or Black men of necessarily of lower income status.
Right.
You had plenty of what they consider middle class Black people that make over $100,000 a year that has lost these jobs.
Right.
Because a lot of these Fortune 500 companies, now it's no incentive to have Black people there, especially after that law was struck down by the Supreme Court. So you've seen a lot of these Fortune 500 companies. In fact, I'm going to mention it in this report from the State of the Dream. It's going to deal with some of the things that you just stated.
Go ahead. Because that's my concern. But my major concern is that we don't use this moment to create a unified governing principle and mission about what we're going to do from here.
Yeah. Well, let me, I'm going to just throw in a couple of these. And again, if somebody wants to jump in, they can do that by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We do have one or two callers sitting there, and I'm gonna get to them right after I share these other things here. Now, that State of the Dream breaks it down into different categories, and people can pull it up and take a look at it, you know, if they're on their computers or on their phone. But let me read a couple of the things here under business, Black businesses, and jobs. It says here, Black businesses face difficult credit constraints in 2025. Traditional bank lending remains exceptionally tight for Black Americans, with 39% of Black-owned businesses denied loans, more than double the 18% denial rate for white-owned firms, experiencing the highest denial rate of any racial group. In the second quarter of 2025, Black-founded startups received only $290.7 million in venture capital funding, placing Black firms on track to finish the year with less than 1% of total capital for a third year in a row. Sadly, loan approvals in 2025 by the Small Business Administration for Black-owned firms fell to 6.5% from 7% in 2024. Now, let me go inside those numbers here, because it says that from venture capital, it talks about people getting money from two different things here. This venture capital, you only get 1% of the money from them. That's almost like non-existent. But then of the Small Business Administration, it fell to 6.5% from 7% in 2024. Now, let's go inside those numbers and look, because it says that it's the lowest of any racial group. But let me look at a couple of other racial groups, because it covers 2024 and 25. Let's look at whites in 2025. They received 56%. Of the Small Business Administration's loans. They had an approval rate of 56%. Black approval rate fell to 6.5%. In 2023, their approval rate was 54.5%. down a little bit from 56. I'm talking about whites. Asian approval rate in 2025 was 16.4%. And in 2024, it was 18.4%. And the Latino approval rate was 20% in 2025, up from 15.3% in 2024. So that puts blacks way behind. I mean, really bringing up the rear. And keep in mind, Richard, that's only, this is Small Business Administration, where the Asians get 16.4% of the money compared to your 6.5%. But that's not the only place. In fact, that's probably their last resort to go to the Small Business Administration to get money, because they have Asian-owned banks.
Right.
They got Asian Businessmen Association in all of these cities. So, listen, I'm not Asian, but I'd be willing to bet that this is their last resort to go and get money. They don't depend on the Small Business Administration to give them money to go into business.
Or they parlay it. Like, they have their own money.
Exactly.
But they parlay it to use somebody else's money.
Exactly. That's exactly. And the same thing with the Latino, especially ones that consider themselves white. Their approval rate is way above yours. And they control both of these Asian and Latino controlled businesses in black communities.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we see who's doing it. The same wizard behind the curtain, but he ain't a wizard. If you're doing your research, you see who's doing it. The ones that are getting 56% of the approval rate. Let me go down a little bit here, read a couple more paragraphs. According to the 2025 analysis by the Harvard School of Law Forum on Corporate Governance, more than 53% of the companies that comprise the S&P 100 made material adjustments to their DEI-related messaging to mitigate legal risk. The companies include Alphabet Incorporated, Amazon, Ford Motor Company, Meta Platform Incorporated, Walmart, McDonald's, all of them scrub DEI terminology from their annual 10K filings, mindful of what it might trigger for regulators and shareholders. This retreat often led to the quiet disillusion of suppliers of diversity programs, directly reducing the pipeline for black-owned firms. Conversely, firms such as Costco, J.P. Morgan, Chase maintain their diversity initiatives, citing the business case for equity. But those initial moves did not tell the full story of the entire year. When conservative shareholders tried to force companies to kill these initiatives through proxy votes, those same companies defended DEI as essential to their business performance. Shareholders supported them 98% of the time, the corporate equivalent of keeping your head down in public while standing your ground when directly challenged. The problem is that this strategy still harms black-owned businesses, even if programs technically survive. When companies stop advertising their suppliers' diversified efforts or rebrand everything as generic or talent initiatives, those programs become invisible and harder to access. The end result is an uncomfortable split where most companies have not actually shuttered their DEI programs. But they have made them quiet enough that the impact on black entrepreneurs looks nearly identical to a full retreat. Two other ones I want to read, then I'm going to go to these callers. Because, let me read this one here. In April 2025, Executive Order 14278 Preparing America for High-Paying Skilled Trade Jobs of the Future, charged the U.S. Secretary of Department of Labor, Commerce, and Education to create plans to reach 1 million apprentices. The U.S. Department of Labor awarded $84 million in grants to expand registered apprenticeships in traditional industries, building trades, construction, and emerging sectors of technology, advanced manufacturing, and transportation. The implications on the black community. Increasing apprenticeships while cutting programs that advance participation of African-American workers and learners could reinforce racial inequality rather than bridge it. Industrial policy investments that explicitly require diversity initiatives to create pathways to high-wage emerging industries have stalled, threatening $115 billion in wages. Meanwhile, the expansion of apprenticeship programs without monitoring by race threatens to replicate historical inequities. Black workers remain underrepresented, earning the lowest wages among apprenticeship completers, a non-dollars per hour average wage, and lack wraparound supports. Emerging industries lose diversity mandates while traditional trades expand without equity accountability. So you see what they're saying, Richard?
Mm-hmm.
So if any young blacks are fortunate enough to get one of these apprenticeships, it's no wraparound benefits for them, because these companies have no incentive to keep those stats anymore. They don't get extra money for hiring black folks. So it says here that they lack the wraparound supports.
And while they're working, they're only getting $9 an hour.
Well, it says they're getting the lowest wages of any apprenticeships in a lot of these programs. Black students, now it covers apprenticeships here, but then it covers something else. Black students' enrollment patterns reflect structural inequities. While participating at demographically appropriate rates, approximately 13%, They're often overrepresented in service fields such as the health sciences, hospitality, and human service, while underrepresented in higher wage science, technology, engineering, and math fields, with some black students earning $8,200 less on average than their white peers. I'm just saying, you know, that's an interesting document because it kind of shows the progress or lack of progress, basically, or the spinning your wheels, or you're on a treadmill and your feet's moving fast, but you're standing in the same spot. If you look at that report, Richard, The State of the Dream, From Regression to Signs of Black Recession, it kind of paints a bleak picture economically for our people in this country, if we continue on a path that some of these so-called leaders want you to continue on.
Now, that's the Urban League, right?
No, this is, I didn't read the Urban League report. This is the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies.
Okay.
And they released the State of the Dream 2026.
You know, what I hear is forced scarcity. And what happens when things are scarce? You have more people. I always use the metaphor of the chair, right? You got 10 chairs and 25 people.
What, that, like that old game, musical chairs?
Here you go. And in this case, I would say the number is greater than 25 to 10. Yeah. And a couple of those chairs are broke. you sit there, you ain't gonna be sitting on that. I shouldn't say that. But it reinforces what is necessary. And maybe everybody is saying, I mean, when I'm talking about the Black, because to me, until we are talking about, I mean, earlier, and you know, you brought it up with this heritage, until the question about, you know, America reviewing this 250, until we become serious about not what I have done, but what is it that we have to do, and not believe that these guys, even allies, are looking out for our best interests, and not dealing with the challenges of the past, what we didn't do or we should have done, but being able to actually learn from those and figure out what's next. Until we do that, I mean, not till we do, we are, but till our language reinforces that's what we're doing. And if nothing, to nobody else, to ourselves and to each other. We see the structural realities once again as they're falling out.
And Richard, a lot of these things are being done as we speak. They might not be as magnified as they should be, but it's not something that collectively we didn't do as a people before.
Right, exactly.
I mean, when we were doing these things before, we wasn't getting no money from no federal government.
Right.
And most of our people that were here in this country was enslaved.
Right.
But we were still generating enough capital between us where we could accomplish what we needed to do. And then once our people fought in that war and freed themselves, then we were able to start educational facilities, and we didn't get no money from these people.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a sacrifice among all of us, because all of us wasn't getting no big salary. It was something that you did for the sake of all of our people and to the community.
Right.
So those things, it's a good chance that those type of things, initiatives, going to probably have to happen again.
It's going to have to happen.
Yes.
The thing is, we have to be able to, I mean, for the next generation, two generations, we have to put in place the security system. Now, I'll stop, but look, Ellie, we were talking earlier, I want to use Iran as an example. They know they can't beat the U.S. militarily, and they knew that at some point the U.S. and Israel was coming for them. But you can't tell me that the strategy that they put in place wasn't from forethought of those realities. That we're watching in real time right now. Whether we think of it as war games or other people or whatever, they knew we could spend $30,000, let them spend $1 million, and that's going to be disruptive. We knew that if we could stop them, their ships moving at what they got their dollar tied to, called oil, we got, regardless of the length of time, we knew if we touched their bases in places that is close to us, that they would be disrupted. And they built for that.
Yeah.
Whether they win or lose is not the question. It's the question that they've had foresight of their opposition. And until we actually have foresight and build institutions that are fortified from the perspective of these guys, at some point, they may, what you call it, emergent conversion or whatever, you know, when it becomes to their convenience, what is it Derek Bell called it?
Interest conversion. Yeah.
Interest conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at some point when they see it's to their convenience. But we, in spite of, got to put institutions, structures, culture, values, and behaviors in place in spite of their convenience.
because we see the fallout. That is if we care about our people.
And
that's what's
and Richard, this, the structure for those institutions is already there.
There you go.
It's almost like I'm always catching the bus, but I got a car parked right outside, and I know how to drive.
Leave me alone.
I'm just using that as an example. Because, listen, the same structures that educated us. Listen, if you remember when we had the it was a group of pastors down there in Florida that that formed a coalition, and when they pulled certain education, black education out of schools, they started using the churches to do it.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about. The structures are already there.
Right.
Now, if I'm a pastor that want to just continue what I've been doing so I can, you know, make a little money, or I'm not saying that all of them do that.
Right.
But, you know, if I want to continue how I've been running my church, then I guess that's your prerogative. But if you know that our people are in trouble and you have to adjust what you're doing for the express purpose of helping our people as a whole, then you can start using those same facilities, those churches, those Hebrew temples, those Muslim mosques that's in use only a couple of days a week. All of them is only in use a couple of days a week. Start using those places as educate, and then you can still have a service if you want to. That don't stop you from having a religious service in the places. But using those places for educational purposes. It's not like we got to reinvent the wheel or start from scratch. The tools are already there.
And I heard the two older churches in Philadelphia, the pastor, the minister of Mother Bethel AME, African Methodist Episcopal, saying to the rector of St. Thomas African Episcopal Church that they need to do a collaborative and having a freedom school, because Mother Bethel ran a freedom school curriculum over Black History Month. And they had a session where they talked about doing that, and they came in agreement. I'm just using that as an example to the point that you're making, that discussion that was raised. So, and these are institutions that go back to the 1700s.
And wait a minute, Richard. Now, I guess that was raised in one of the meetings you attended.
Right.
Well, see, that's what I'm talking about. See, we have black media. You got a station here in Philadelphia. It's only four of them in the country that's black owned. See, those things need to be promoted among black media. You got a black ministers coalition here in this city. Those things need to be pushed. If that idea happened at a private meeting in two of prominent churches, they're not the largest, but they're prominent. Mm-hmm. If they're involved in doing that, that needs to spread. Then we can offset some of this damage. Other than that, we can't offset this damage by begging these people, put it back in the public school. They're not going to do it, even though you pay taxes. And that's another strategy, too, that can be used. Because they can't keep taking your tax money and just doing whatever they want to do, and you just sit there being some type of pawn or dupe. He didn't do that when Britain was taking his tax money. They said, no, we ain't going for that. You remember what they did.
Oh, yeah.
So why should we go for it? If they taking our tax money and doing what your schools look like somebody threw a bomb in there, but then when you go into white neighborhoods, they got books, the schools look presentable, it look like educational facilities. Yours look like some type of prison. It's dark. You going in places, it's dark. I mean, where's like they don't turn the lights on in the darn places.
You're right.
Let me go to a couple of calls. Let's go to Norfolk Newport News first.
You got me laughing, Brother Elliot. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear.
No, I'm going to try to keep it short because some of the things you were talking about, even the church, I can tell you over the years, when try to talk about even the local churches here, and I'm from a country place, when you start talking these things about programs, you know what these people say. The same thing you hear from any other capitalist. Well, you know, Brother Griffin, that's going to run the bills up. We got to pay water and we got to turn the heat on. Who are we going to get to clean? I'm just telling you. I'm not judging. I'm telling you what's happened.
No,
In other words,
you're right.
They won't. Let me say this. They don't even have enough respect for the needy. They're supposed to be Christ-driven. That you present the services and ask for donations. Or do what you do when you go to these white folks and bypass the zoning and building codes to get what you want added on to the church, and it ain't done by code. But I'm going to get back to the other part that I want to say to you. Most disappointing thing I can say at 72, and I've been an activist for a majority of my life, but personally, just in the last 10 years, I use social media, and I tell people all the time, it's a public diary for me. I don't care how many views and likes I get. I try to spread information. Even like with your program, when I ask you for links, you can go back and look at my Twitter feed and find out that I'm sharing that in spaces that are active while you're active. And I'm going to tell you what happens. Just in the time that you've been on air, I can send you in an email where I've gone in four spaces where I've heard educated people that I've followed for several years with degrees, some with multiple degrees. And they're in there babbling like you're talking to an elementary school. They want to tell you what they're feeling, and they're honest. They don't realize how honest they're being. I want to get this out because I'm telling you, I hear y'all and you're putting in work and you're talking about brothers like Maurice Carver. It doesn't matter how much information you share. If people want to be absorbed in their feelings, I put information that you just happen to be talking about because they're talking about. I heard it earlier today before you came up. They're lying about us losing jobs. Ain't nobody losing no jobs where I am. These are the people holding spaces, pontificating. So I literally went in and put some of the reports you just said. That's why I asked for the links. I can guarantee you when I go back and check, those same people, because I'm a master troll, those same people will ignore the comments, but I'm so deliberate, I go to their page and put it on there, and some will remove the post rather than absorb the information. So my point to you is that's most of our problem in this country. Those who have been educated don't want to live in reality, I tell them. They don't have any situational awareness. They're living in a world they created with false constructs. And there's nothing you can do to pierce that. That's why I try to spend more time with young people who haven't gotten that fossilized mindset yet. I'm going to let you go back to doing your job, but I wanted to get this on air because I'm going to clip it and send it to them all week long. I troll ignorant people. My dad used to say it all the time, and I thought it was a lie. There's no fool worse than an educated fool. You'll never get them to change their mind. Peace. Keep putting in that work.
And I just, you know, Elliot, what Brother Otis just brought up is the point that I was making of my concern about that social stratification, because he's correct.
That's why I tried to help you with it, because you get a little deep, but I'm a country nigga.
You two better leave me alone. But I mean, I hear it. I hear it, and it's like frustrating because, as you say, they, you know, and Carter Woodson said it. You know, other people said it. And the thing about the sheepdog come in my mind. You know, you train a sheepdog by putting them among sheep, and they think they are sheep. They just go outside of their own nature. I'll leave that alone. But I appreciate that, Brother Otis, because that I see it.
I'm just being honest, man. I'm country. I see no need of trying to coat the medicine in sugar. Just ram it down your throat and deal with it. Because I'm telling you, I'm shocked. I some of these people, I'll engage them and ask them questions. And once you pin them down and give them the information. How do you know that? The same way you think you knew yours. I do research and I use logic. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know you knew about that. You don't know nothing about me. The point is the information I'm giving you. Does the information make sense? I didn't dream it up. This is where I learned it. I'll give you the information. I don't want to hear that stuff. Now you're putting up some stuff so-and-so did 30 years ago. you old fool. Well, how are you going to decide that I'm an old fool when you can't even figure out whether or not the information I'm giving you makes sense or not? You're just going to reject it because it shatters your supposed to be logical belief. Not anything to support the belief other than that's how I feel. I'm telling you, when they say that, you might as well close the door and walk away.
Oh, true that.
Let's go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia.
Hey, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Good show, fellas. How y'all doing tonight?
Good.
Yeah.
Praise be to Allah. You know, Brother Elliot, you and Richard, y'all gave me a lot to... you and Richard, your sex good information, y'all gave me a lot to decipher from tonight, man. I'm telling you, man. But you know, Elliot, when you played those clips by Meeks earlier, you made me think about a few things, stuff. I don't know if you and Richard heard, y'all probably didn't hear yet, that despicable, hateful, violent regime that people like Gregory Meeks and Jeffries and Richie Torres and Warnock and Ivy and the rest of them Negroes support a Palestinian family, a mother, father, and I think their five-year-old child was coming back from Ramadan. They was coming back from breaking the fast at Ramadan, and they got gunned down by Israeli forces. You know, there was a real threat to the Israelis. They was just coming back. My business. The Palestinian sister was shot in the face. I'm gonna say it again. She was shot in the face and stuff. The man was shot in the back. Both of them killed. The child is surviving, but in bad condition. And this is these are the people that your black elected leaders support, man. I don't know how long, Brother Elliot, the black media can keep on propping these niggas, because they're not Negroes, they niggas, like the Jeffries and the Mixer, where they can support this racist, evil regime that will shoot children, that will shoot men, innocent women, shot the woman in the face, man. Damn, I mean, how evil can you be, you know? And remember back during the strike on guys in the hospital, remember last year when you had talked about it earlier, where they bombed the hospital and then when the workers and the first aid people came, how Israel struck and killed them. Remember that incident, Elliot?
That was on video.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll see again. It's the white mainstream media is not telling the whole story. I was listening to an Iranian brother today, and he said when they hit that school over there, United Snakes of America and Israel, when they hit that school, they did a double tap. What happened? And so the list always to understand the mentality, the devilish, like the Honorable Elijah Humphrey said, the white man's mentality, his evilness. I don't care whether they call themselves white Jews, white Christians, white Polish, Italians, they Europeans, they got a sick, evil, sick, sadistic mentality. But when they struck the school in Iran in the first hours of the war, or first day of the war and stuff, concerned parents, when they heard about this and stuff, they, of course, like any parent, you know your child, you go up to the school. So parents came to the school to see what condition their children or grandchildren, they knew it was some fatalities, and they wanted to see if their child had survived it or whether it was badly injured. Well, the parents came up and they met their fate as well, because as the parents were coming to the school of Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, and it's time for the wicked list order, Israel did another strike when they seen a rescue plate with the ambulance and the concerned parents. They did another airstrike. So not only did they kill the innocent children and the teachers and the staff, they also killed parents, grandparents, and medical people that came up there. And they knew these people was there out of concern and to try to get the injured, the dead out of there. But Israel, once again, just like they did in Gaza, killed them as well. These are some sick, evil bastards, man. And like I said, again, I'm going to continue to say it till I'm blue in the face. How long can the black media protect Hakeem Jeffries, Gregory Meeks, Warnock, Richie Torres, Ivy, and all these house niggas that support Israel? They are supporting blood money. This is an evil, sick-ass regime. They are evil and devilish to the core. I don't want you to hear no damn stuff about no damn Holocaust. When you showing right now your evilness, you killing people, you talking about what Hitler did to you. Look what the hell you doing to other people of color. They're evil bastards, man. It's evil to the core. I can't emphasize that enough, Ellie Richard. They are evil to the damn core. Man, I'm tired. I've never seen such evil people. They damn near make Hitler look like a choir boy. You know? I mean, damn. I mean, man, I'm tired. I guess, man, I'm telling these people are sick, man. That's all I can say. They are sick. And again, your black elected officials getting money, and you got a woman that's right here in Philadelphia and stuff. She's running for Congress. This doctor, this black female doctor, Alice Sanford, and she's getting money from AIPAC. Are you kidding me? Please. Man, I'm telling you, and we still believe she gonna get in there and fight for black people when she already shown who she gonna dance to when them Zionists tell her to jump, she gonna say how high, you know? It's disgraceful, man. But again, as long as you got black media, whether it's print or electronic, cheerleading for these Negroes instead of holding them accountable for getting money from these people, the beat goes on, and the beat goes on. And like you got the Negroes established, they all happy about this Negro in New York, Jeffries, becoming House Speaker. Like, I give a damn about him becoming some House Speaker. Ain't gonna do a damn thing for my financial back pocket. I'm gonna still be on the same income I'm in now, whether he becomes Speaker or not. All he do, as Richard said, political entrepreneurs, all he gonna do is enhance his own financial benefit. Ain't gonna do nothing for those poor black people in New York City that's struggling to make ends meet, that's struggling to get up below above the poverty line. Black schools in New York, just like schools in Philadelphia, are still suffering with torn down old buildings with asbestos in it, you know, outdated textbooks, you name the stuff, and ills our children pay food deserts. So what the hell, how the black community in New York will benefit if this nigga becomes House Speaker? But you have these ignorant Negroes in the black media and these black, oh, just cheerleading and stuff because he become House Speaker. Oh, he the first black, have we learned that yet? We had the first black man in Philadelphia. We've seen what happened. The whole damn black neighborhood got burnt down. 11 black people got incinerated, women as well as adults. Yet we still caught up into this damn first black. We got this first black female boy here in Philadelphia, and so far she's been a disaster. I mean, have we learned yet from this first black stuff, that Negro that was in the White House for 8 years? 8 years in the poverty level and economic thing needed for black folks didn't be one iota when this Negro was in office for 8 years. He of the one who Trump called him and his wife monkeys, and he gonna use Reverend Jackson's funeral to get his stuff off from Trump. If you're any kind of damn man, you'd have blasted that devil as soon as he said you're gonna wait till Reverend Jackson's funeral to trash Trump. You spineless Negro, you. You know? Come on, man. I want to pick up. I know you have made other two callers, so let me let you go on that note. I just want to express myself, and I get off, and I'll listen to the remainder of the show, Elliot.
Let me ask you something. You said you were talking to, because I know you go to meetings here in Philadelphia with a lot of different folks. Where did you see these folks at that you were talking to in reference to what's going on over there currently?
Well, I went to a meeting earlier. I went to a meeting yesterday, of course, with Brother Stanley. I went to a meeting today with some people down at Temple. You know, they're like young activists. But I heard the report about the woman getting shot in the face. I saw that on TV as you and Richard was you know, speaking and stuff. They mentioned on MSNBC on the weekend prime time. But yeah, but like I said, but I heard about the double take down at Temple where the Iranian student stood. What happened? He said he said that the Al Jazeera pointed out about how they killed this a Palestinian family that was coming home from Ramadan. You know. But what I heard about this situation where they double strike that was on MSNBC tonight, where they said about how they hit the school and then they hit it again instead when the parents and everybody else came out to try to get the dead and injured out of there, you know. See, you're not going to hear these things on mainstream media for a lot of times. It's shocked they even mentioned it on MSNBC. But you sure as hell ain't going to hear it a lot of times on black media, because black media often get their marching orders from white media. That's why sometimes you listen to black media, you might as well listen to some of these white media, because they be putting news just like the white man does. But you expect them to be different, but a lot of times they are not different, you know, which is a disappointment, because you go back to the days of the Pittsburgh, the print media back with the Pittsburgh Courier, the Chicago Defender. These are strong black institutions that challenged the status quo. They challenged black leadership. They challenged the white media. But often this black media we got now is so weak and spineless and stuff. Like I said, they get their match orders from the white media, so it's almost like a letdown when you listen to them or read them or stuff. Like, he in Philadelphia, Elder, you know this. You got the oldest black paper in the country, the Tribune. And I swear, sometimes it ain't worth the paper, the ink of the paper is printed on, man. I read that stuff. I be saying, damn, I'm going to buy a white newspaper. I want to hear this garbage. You know what I mean? That's why I'm buying the Tribune. It's the purpose to get alternative media that's going to give a black perspective or more of a humane perspective. But damn, they be putting news just like the white media do, you know? So, you know, you say, well, damn, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, you know?
Well, listen, Rella, eventually somebody's going to, because, I got faith in our people, even though you got some people that's traditionally going to do what they're going to do. But some people are going to change their mindset. I do believe that. And eventually, just like Dr. King had that speech at Riverside Church, where he said mm-hmm. the United States was the largest purveyor of violence on the planet, basically, and called them out. You're going to have somebody, whether it's clergy as a group, you know, because I know it's fear among some of our people to do it individually. So if that's the case, then do it as a group. Just to speak on these things, you got to. Because you can see that the guy that's head of Dr. King's church now, that he's not going to say anything. It's clear that he's not.
No, he's not.
He takes money from these groups. He takes money from one of the groups that's involved in the bombing. And plus, he's silent on it. When that brother confronted him at the church, he had an opportunity then to say, well, brother, listen, I know you supported me, and it's wrong for me to buy. You know, he had an opportunity then. He didn't do
it. Sure. And I'm glad you raised that point. And I just want to make it clear, I'm never going to lose faith in our people. In spite of all this stuff, even though I may sound on a downcast right now, I love our people too much. I came too far to give up on our people and stuff. I remain optimistic and stuff, because I know at some point we're going to prevail. As Jesse said, keep hope alive. And as the late Marcus Messiah Garvey say, you know, up you mighty nation, you can accomplish what you will. And I firmly believe it. I don't just say it just to sound good or whatever. I believe in my heart and without really fight with my soul that we're going to make it as a people. And we're going to overcome all this stuff. We're going to overcome these sellout Negroes that live among us and stuff, because they're going to be, as the old saying goes, Ellen Richard, they'll be put in the dustbins of history for their traitors' ways. They're going to be a footnote in history. So they think they're riding high now, the Jeffries and the mix of the world, but at some point they're going to be a footnote in the dustbins of black history for their traitors' ways, because history will not be kind to them. When you purposely sell your people down the drain, when you purposely, and these men are not stupid, when you purposely get money from a group of people that support an act of murder and mayhem and genocide, you're not going to get your blessings for that. So they think they're riding high now, but if you remember black history as well as history itself, will not remember these men kindly. They're gonna pay for that. They're gonna pay a heavy price for this, for their treacherous ways, because they know better. But they purposely, like, and a good example in closing, at least Glenn Ivey, when the sister confronted him, she said, "You're gonna stop taking money. You know what the genocide? Well, I'm not gonna stop taking money. How inhumane can you be? You know these people over there killing Palestinian women and children every day, and you're gonna sit there and tell that woman you're not going to stop taking money. Where's your morality? Where's your human decency at, man? Damn, you know? But it just shows you they have none. You know, they're almost like these Europeans, Elliot. That would be why I said, but these Europeans, they don't have no morals. They amoral, which means they lack morals. But this is how some of these black politicians like the Jeffries, the Glenn Ivers, the Warnocks of the world, and he more be despicable because he's going to be a man of the cough, and he get money from these genocidal maniacs and stuff, man. It's a sin and a shame. But like you said, we just got to keep our nose to the grindstone, because our people waking up, they're going to start holding these Negroes accountable. The Al Sharpton's of the world, this host that we have in Philadelphia, and all the rest of them that want to protect these Negroes, they ain't going to be better protecting too much longer, because the war is being pulled off these Negroes as this genocide increases in Iran and Palestine and everywhere else, where these devils, these Zionists killing people and murdering people over in Lebanon, Elliot, in closing. Over in this war so far, it's bad enough you done killed these children. children in Iran, you know, killing children and guys in Syria. They done killed over 200 children already in Lebanon. I mean, they just murderers, man. They just load these white Zionist Jews are number of racist, murdering scum. That's what they are. They are scum. Simple as that. And how long these Negroes think they're going to keep supporting them and getting away with it? They're reckoning this coming. That's why it says hold fast. They say in the Christian church, just hold fast, brothers and sisters, that they're reckoning this coming. And I close with that, okay, brother?
Thanks for your contribution.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Let's go to Hazleton, then we're going to New York City. Hazleton, PA?
Respectfully to the West Philly brother, nothing is changing because you guys respectfully won't tell Black America to stop voting. Now, Elliot, respectfully, I called about a month ago, but before that, it's been about 8-9 months since the summer. I hear the same things. The only way that it's going to change is when the baby boomers die. And he brought up Al Sharpton. Jesse Jackson just died. When somebody says something to me, I'm not going to tell y'all because I'm going to be respectful. I ain't going to tell y'all what I said when I heard Jesse Jackson is dead. Like, I'm waiting on Al Sharpton, long hair, don't care. I want to know all the baby boomers from the Kathy Hughes station, respectfully. I'm waiting for them to get out of here. That's the only way it's going to be a change, because y'all still won't tell people to stop voting.
Wait a minute.
So it's not, you can hold on all you want. The brother said, hold on. It's not going to change. I've been saying this for years. Look at what the immigrants did to old girl down in Texas. How many years have I called you? Elliot, you've been doing this for over 20 years. For people who don't know, Elliot's been doing this for over 20 years. Because I called him 20 years ago. So he's been doing this a long time.
Yeah, but you heard me telling people to vote?
Huh?
You heard me encouraging people to vote?
No, but y'all talk about politicians. The last caller just talked about politics. Look, he's someone who warned us about the mayor of Philadelphia, 10, 12 years ago? I'm going to give him credit. He said she's no bueno 10, 12 years ago, he told us that. And then they go out and vote for her anyway. So what did I tell you, Elliot? The man that was just on the – I keep forgetting his name because I first heard him – on the sports stations back in the day. I'm talking about in the 90s. I heard him on the sports station. I forgot he's from West Philly. What's his name? So I could give him credit. They're just called.
Joe from Germantown.
Joe from Germantown. Right. I keep calling him West Philly, but Germantown. Joe from Germantown. I remember him from back in the day. I gave him some love, and he turned on me. But that's not going to take away from what he used to do back in the day. I gave him some love, and he turned on me on this show. Which is fine, but I'm not that type of cat. I'm cut from a different cloth. My brother and my father, my grandfather, we cut from different cloths. So I'm not going to turn on him because he turned on me. But he said the mayor 10, 12 years ago was no good. And what do? They go out and vote for it anyway. That's what I'm saying. If y'all go and y'all have these bully pokers, you, Carl Nelson, Al Sharpton, Tavis Smiley. I could go down the list. Back in the day, I used to listen to Warren Ballantyne. Y'all got this bully puppet, and y'all won't tell Black people, hey, stay away from immigrants. Y'all scared to say that. Stay away from feminists. Stay away from the Democrat Republican parties, both from working families, Federalists, the Constitutionalist Party, the Conservative Party, the Independent Party, the Green Party, the Working Family. Go on and on. I could go down the list. It's like 20, 25 of them. People think there's only two. It's like 20 of them. Stay away from this. Coalesce under whatever flag you coalescing under. And that's the way to do it, and then come together under the flag. But y'all want this whole one big gumbo pot of Blackness. That ain't how it works. My what I need in America is different than what a Jamaican that just got here, a Honduras just got here, a Cuban that just got here, respectfully, a Canadian, a Israeli. It's different than what my people need here, Elliot. And that's what I be telling you. Y'all got to do and say something different. Y'all don't.
You got the opportunity.
It's the same recycled baby boomer garbage.
You got the opportunity. You got the opportunity right now, so I can, as I leave here as one of those baby boomers, you have the opportunity right now to put in my ear what
Richie, respectfully, how many times have I called here and tried to put in your ear? Go listen to a show during the summer when I called you.
Do it now. I'm like,
what do you mean? You want me to keep regurgitating 20 years what I've been telling y'all? I just told you what my platform is. I want Black Americans to get right, and then we'll worry about everybody else. I can't worry about the, even though it's a problem for me for Israeli to be bombing Arabs, but like I told Carl a couple of weeks ago, the Arabs and the Jews in New York, where I grew up, treated my father and my you know, my grandmother died. She died having being Crown Heights working for them. She used to work for them. My grandmother died at 80 years old. She went to work that day cooking and cleaning for them before she had a heart attack that night. My uncle and my father in the living room crying. I'm like, why are y'all crying? I came down and said I was out in the street. Came in the street, they crying. So I don't care about the Israeli or the Muslims, to be honest, because they both treated us terrible in New York. But at the same time, I got enough humanity to say, you don't kill, as Joe say, you don't kill 40, 50, 60, 70,000 people, mostly women and children. It's crazy. So I'm just, at the time, I'm saying, say something and do something different. You get these Black religious people that don't want to stick up for nothing because they want to keep the 501. You know Trump want to do something for me? Get rid of all religious 501c3s. No more nonprofits is able to get tax breaks because they're not doing anything anyway. I told you before, I've been out here homeless since 2020 June. I'm still homeless. I don't call up here asking for anything or complaining. I've been homeless since June of 2020 at the height of COVID. But it's the same regurgitated garbage on here, on all these Black media. Even Joe complained about the media. Every media, it's the same thing. When you get somebody that, like me, is outspoken, y'all never invite me to events. I'm willing to come to events scared, and I'm not scared of nothing. I've been in every hood on the East Coast where you could go by myself. I'm not scared of anything, but y'all don't never invite somebody like me because y'all don't know what I'm going to say or do. And I understand that. But listen to regurgitated slop day in and day out. I'm sick of it. No one's against, no one's anti-immigrant in the Black media. Why? No one's anti-feminist. Why? No one's anti-abortion. Why? No one's anti-voting. Why? I've been against voting since I voted 25 years ago. Why is nobody against these things? I'm anti, with all due respect, my father was a pan-African. I'm against that. But you can't bring me, somebody like me, to the table because y'all don't know what he's going to say or do. Because I'm going to criticize this baby boom. They need to die, and then the community can heal. Respectfully, I read a book in 2019 called what? Generation of Sociopaths. Go get it and read it. And then you'll see why. But even before that, I was anti-baby boomer. All that book did is reinforce what I already knew. That's all that book did.
Who's the author?
I'm like sick of it. Like, Joe criticized the media too. It's the same old slop.
Who is the author of that? And state the name of the book again.
Generation of Sociopaths.
And who's, do you know who the author is?
Top of my head, damn. Gibney. G-I-B-N-E-Y. Yeah, Gibney. I think Bruce Gibney is his first name. The ex-old lady still got it because I bought it for her. I also bought her the autobiography of Malcolm X. She loved that book. So I'm not anti-giving people things that they could use to help other Black Americans. I'm not against that. Just because I don't co-sign Malcolm X, I go with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, don't mean that I can't give somebody a book and help them. She was like, that's the best book I ever bought her. Because that's what I do. I'm not against Africa. I'm not against immigrants, so to speak. All I know is I got to take care of Black Americans because I see the suffering every day. It's like 20 of us in a circle out here in Jersey, in South Jersey. All of them are Black Americans. They're suffering. I can't worry about an immigrant. I can't worry about an Arab or a Muslim or a Jew. I can't do that, especially when I grew up again in New York, when I know how these people treat us. Treated my grandmother like garbage. They treated my father worked for them too, treated him like garbage. But I don't care about these people. And when I call, got a problem with it. Al Sharpton got a problem with it. Elliot used to have a problem with it until more and more people started, I guess, waking him up to this immigrant thing. Look what they did down in Texas. They're not going to change. It's just going to get worse. They're just getting more and more number. Hispanics are soft, yo. I've been against two and three of them at a time. Most of them are soft if they're not running in a group. They soft. Yeah, I said it. They soft if they're not running in a group. If it's not five or six of them with knives or guns or something, they soft. Believe me, I've been around them, extorted them, them went in their pockets. Talking recently, they soft. All these people are soft. That's why I don't understand why Black American men don't stand up, take back the community, yo. I don't understand why this is so hard. I've run by myself in the streets. You name the area on the East Coast that I've been in, from New York down to Jacksonville, and get nothing but love from the Black American community because they see me coming as a man, looking them in their eye, shaking their hands, and talking to them as men. That's what y'all got to do, too, as baby boomers. Instead of every morning at 6 o'clock on the Nelson show complaining about our children. That's weak. I don't need to complain about my children. I see them out here and they call me unk. They show me respect. They look me in my eye, call me unk. Tattoos all in their face. Gun on the waist. Nobody's scared of them. All they need is some right direction. But y'all don't want, nobody want to talk about it. They want to always talk about Chicago. So they never talk about the immigrant towns like L.A. and Miami and New York City. They always talk about Philly. They always talk about Baltimore, D.C. I was just out in D.C. Kids, them youngins, they children to me, man. So that's all I'm asking. And I'm going to get off too. Like I said, I show Joe love because I think he got some good ideas and stuff. I don't care about no Arab. I don't care about no Muslim, man, until they care about me. I don't care about none of these groups that come over here until they care about me. That's all I'm saying is Black men, Black American men, wake up. We won't be here in 50 years. We won't. All this mixing, ethnic mixing, race mixing, this is trash. A lot of these light-skinned kids you see on TV, you don't know what they are. What are they? Oh, little curly head, little thin 5'8" curly head boys. I don't know what they are. They be all mixed mixture.
Let me say this. I'm looking up Bruce Cannon Gibbons. And this is just the Wikipedia write up, and this is for the Time for Awakening audience to say, just to hear. Gibbons is an American writer and venture capitalist. A venture capitalist. He was one of the first investors of PayPal and went to work for PayPal founder Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel, yes, we know him.
Hold on. Everybody know the extremist anti-black person that is now currently, got his hand in the back of the President 47. Peter Thiel's hedge fund, Carlium, and his venture capital company founder fund.
You're trying to slander me. That's what baby boomers do. Go ahead, slander.
I can understand what he's saying amongst those baby boomers, because black baby boomers do not have the wealth.
If you read the book, he says that. He says, I'm not talking about black baby boomers. If you read the book, that's what he says in the book. We're not talking about black baby boomers, but I am.
Okay. So you, I ain't got no more to say. I'll just leave it at that.
Thanks for your contribution, bro. Let's go up to New York City. New York.
Unbelievable, man. He was on his meds and Richard got him off of his meds that quick. Tried to criticize the information that he clearly was trying to give you about the psychopaths. Oh, Richard, you almost had him, man. You almost had him. But the reality is this. put it into context. What he's basically saying is that black people have to be for black people and have to separate themselves from all other ethnic groups and move forward with an agenda that will lead to our survival. They have to become what we are witnessing right now at this time with the Israelis are facing by the Iranians who are busting their ass. And nobody in the media, like Sean says, is telling the honest truth about it because they're scared of the pushback. Here it is, now you got the president of the United States who's supposed to be the leader of the free world get manipulated by evil bastard, more evil than he is, setting his people now up to be slaughtered by people who have positioned themselves over the last 20 years to defend their sovereign rights. Here it is. This man has been manipulated by this filthy, stinking, no-good, diabolical Jew who don't care nothing about anybody other than Jewish people, who basically manipulated a retard and a dumbass to go in here to bomb a country that they thought they was going to be able to wipe out within a day or two because they was able to go in, kidnap and take a Baba Louie Venezuelan, and bring him to so-called justice, and they thought they was going to be able to go into Iran and do that. And here it is, which they've given them 20 years to prepare, getting their ass waxed. But nobody's telling the truth about the amount of Americans that have probably been killed, the amount of Americans that's about to be killed, all for a goddamn country that don't care nothing about me and you, that we will rebuild. But here it is, like Sean said, he can't get nothing from this country to help him and his plight. But we go support this bullshit. And that's the sadness of, you're not going to hear no criticism, no serious deep analysis about what's going on and how we being manipulated. Well, they're being manipulated. I'm not being manipulated, but the fact that here it is now, people, children are going to have to die, and when it's all said and done, Iran is going to stand and Israel is going to be rebuilt by America. And if it really go way off base, the United States is going to suffer. You already see what your gas prices are like, but they're starting to put out the fact what your food prices are about to become. Then you got all the other things going on with AI. It's just a situation to whereas we shouldn't even be involved in this bullshit. Because our country, or so-called country, or whatever the hell you want to call it, is being systematic robbed and destroyed by a narcissistic psychopath, all in the agenda of whiteness. And the sad thing is, most Negroes think the only thing that's going to save their black ass is, like Sean said, a vote. We sick, boss. Like Malcolm said, we sick, boss. A vote is not going to do anything but prolong your suffering in this country. I don't care who you put in the office. I'll give you a prime example. Please listen to this clearly. And your boy in New York, excuse me for forgetting his name, the one that calls up that got the TV show and all of this. He need to be on his TV show criticizing the Negro that we all so love and support and feel sorry for, Yusuf Salam, that's displacing black people out of Harlem. I live in Harlem. He's displacing black people out of Harlem. Instead of listening to someone like Charles Barry, and you need to get Charles on the show because he'll verify everything that I'm saying. Now, I'm not sure what the median income is in Brooklyn, in Bed-Stuy, which is basically the same economically as Harlem, that Charles Barron used to keep them developers in check. Here it is, this the despicable Negro who we done kissed his ass and did everything that allowed this cracker to come in here and tell the black community that the median income is now $44,000. I done lived in Harlem for over 60 years. I'm telling you the fair median income would probably be 30 to 35 at best. So now what he's done is he's basically displacing most of the black people in Harlem from living in Harlem for some cracker. And here it is, we talk about he's a leader. Listen, the one who's done manipulating him and who controls him, Bruce Wright's son, Keith Wright, his daddy in the goddamn grave every night turning over and puking for what his son is doing to black people. And I know his daddy and know him too. The reality is this. We never collectively take care of ourselves like Sean says. We're always trying to integrate with our oppressor and our enemy. And that's why we're staying in this position. Ain't no way in hell, no way in hell, Harlem median income is $44,000. I've lived in Harlem for 61 years. My assets are in the seven figures. And I'm telling you as somebody who knows a whole bunch of people in this community, in the neighboring neighborhoods, the median income, like I said, is 30 to 35. And the sad thing is, in all of this, I would just like to know, like Sean says, where are black people going to be in the next couple of years? Where are we going to be at? And the only reason, to be honest with you, that Harlem hasn't become totally gentrified is because of the simple fact that the project and the crackers are too scared to come up too close to them, even though they're safer here than they are any place in the world. Ain't no black person gonna do nothing to a white person. I come in the house sometime 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm watching these crackers walking dogs, talking some nonsense about hello. Come on, man. We better wake up because the bottom line is we as a people are about to become extinct. And I think the brother name is Maurice. Yeah, Maurice. He should be doing a damn show about that damn Yusef Salaam. Black people done did to support him, he come in and he don't even listen to Charles. And Charles got the blueprint.
They haven't
even been able to gentrify Charles' community. Maurice will tell you that. But there it is now. This. Oh man!
Wait a minute.
He came in, got elected.
Yeah, but let me ask you something.
He's a white man.
Excuse me. He's been, because we talked about that on the program here. He's been working with, I think it's a Jewish member or head of city council to push these initiatives in the city where city money, New York City taxpayer money, including black taxpayers, is going towards security at Jewish facilities, educating anti-Semitism in public schools, We're our that's, children.
That's the norm, Elliot. That's normal behavior from Negroes like that, man. Yeah, but I'm talking but about he done is... now allowed them to come in and set it up to displace black people who've been here for 60 or 70 years.
I understand what you're saying. But see, he's not a... And see, this is where we got to understand that this is not about any boomers and baby boomers and all, because that guy, although I don't put no stock in all that, that guy is not a baby boomer. He's not.
Who?
Yusuf Salam.
I think he's probably in his 50s or late 40s.
Well, he's not a baby boomer.
No, he's not a baby boomer.
I know.
No.
But he don't have integrity. So I don't care whether you're a baby boomer, Generation X, Z, XYZ, whatever. If you don't have integrity, you're a problem to black people. It's about integrity.
Hey, Ellie, could you? I know you almost about to go off, but could you do something right quick? Could you get Maurice on the line? Because I really want to ask him what's his take on it, because we're getting ready to wind up.
But he'll call. He'll probably call next week. Yeah, but thanks for your contribution. I understand what you're saying, but thanks for your contribution.
Yeah, but I mean, I just want to thank you, man, because listen, you know, I laugh when I hear Sean, but there's if he's on his meds, there's definitely information that he's putting out there that's real talk, because we're being manipulated on a serious level. And the thing is, Elliot, we ain't winning. We're not winning. Well, but hey, brother, all we can do is keep fighting.
Well, put it
this
way.
You know, you got to fight to win.
Let me tell you this. I know that we're winning more than you think, because the enemy is putting up a concerted effort to give the world the impression that you're buying into this. See, the world already knows how Europeans think. They know. What these people are doing is giving the world the impression that you're buying into this. That's why they show Meeks, Jeffries, Warnock, all these people all on the boob tube showing that they're a part of this. They need to show that. You're the key to all this. See, that's why we don't have time to focus in on all that minutia about some immigrant, a black immigrant from other countries. People are struggling. Our brothers and sisters that are Afro-Venezuelans, brothers and sisters in the islands, they all know that their struggle against this man is different than ours. Any fool knows that. People on the continent that has been neocolonialized, that we come from, they know that their struggle against this man, all of it is different. It's not the same. We all know that. But we got a common enemy. And we need to unite. That's what he don't want. He don't want us uniting and fighting. That's how you believe. But all of the people that you recognize as contributors to our struggle, whether it was Garvey, Delaney, Malcolm, any of these people, know that that's the key to all that. Even this man know it. That's why he labeled Garvey the most dangerous man in the United States. He knew that what Garvey was doing would tear his kingdom down. So just keep that in mind. If you don't believe that, that's up to you. But
I understand that, just like they said Fred Hampton was also the most dangerous. They pick and choose when the time is necessary to use whatever form of rhetoric they need to cut down the so-called savior But thank you again, brother. And I look forward to hearing what Maurice got to say about this, because the bottom line is, when it's all said and done, Elliot, you know, if we're going to be truthful, where we going?
Thanks for your contribution, brother.
Thank you, brother.
Brother Elliot.
Yes, sir.
Elliot,
yes, sir.
I'm having a senior moment, and I'm going to tell you, we really have to spend about 30 minutes the next time you have an open forum and talk about what you just been presented with. The person who was cited here, if you look through his resume, as the man was saying Richard was trying to sully his information, that man is a frat brother from the very people who have put together everything from social media to Palantir, SpaceX, and now the data centers that are poisoning our people from Memphis to you name it. And he brought that up as a justification for what baby boomers are doing. Oh, I swear to you, you can't make this stuff up. Gil Scott-Heron got it better than anybody in the last place. A new crop is coming. This shit is on fire, and I'm ready to be the senior moment belligerent-ass boomer. Bring it on.
Okay. I don't want to say nothing because it's and the thing is, there's so many of them that are.
I want all the smoke. Give it to my old gray hair. Bring it on.
There's so many of them saying this, and when you look like they're following the thoughts of these guys.
Oh, you got to be kidding me! When you read off that little bit of bio, I said, "Wait, what? What? You know? Okay."
And what you call it, he just put in the whole that whole connection. I mean, like, but the thing is not, this is a thought amongst, I don't know what generation he is. I don't know. It don't matter to me. But this is what they have cultivated. And this is a cultivation. And I mean, it's here. But I would say it ain't no new thing, because these are black. These are people who are, you know, I mean, Nelson, she calls it conflicted natives.
Why didn't you talk about, I said I'm homeless. Spoke about me.
On one hand, can be able to say that, you know, from the perspective of being black, but on the other hand, reinforcing the same dominating thoughts and ideals directed to black people, because he said, I ain't read the book, but he said, yes, the boomers that this guy was talking about wasn't black boomers. He's saying black boomers. So that even makes it, he's, you know, like, I got to go home, Elliot. I'm sorry.
Listen, I enjoyed it tonight. Listen, before we leave tonight, let me get the lineup on Time for an Awakening Media. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting topics, dialogue, and guests on African Perspectives. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on Monday evenings from 7 to 9, Our Story with Bubba West Johnson and Brother Johnny as hosts. Live from New Orleans, Louisiana. And then they double back on Wednesday night at the same time, 7 to 9 p.m. Our Story. Thursdays, the door is always open for the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi. Brother Patrick Lumumba, Sister Crystal Denise, Brother Rodney Lowe, Brother Malik Hayes, four hosts, one mission, the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi. Mississippi on the Move. Then Sundays. Pinckney to Pinckney, 5 to 6, and Time for an Awakening from 6 until. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back next week, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know. The things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do so. play such a small part of the things that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. She got to teach school. If we know, all we say we know about the problem. To save the children.